Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of your favourite audio hobby medium. Yes, it is the Conclave 40K. Well, we're not really Conclave 40K anymore, which is good, because we're going to get into this in this episode. We're going to cover everything. We've got loads to talk about, and it's not just because we haven't recorded for ages, because we've been on holiday, and we will have lives to lead. And to be honest, this is probably just a monthly podcast now, and we hope that's okay for you listeners. But it does mean that in the in-between times, loads of things happen in loads of game systems, and frankly, we just want to talk about it all. So tonight, because we're recording in the evening, shockingly enough, we are going to be covering the Mortal Realms. Yes, the world of AOS, and, you know, I know Mr. War Hipster, who is joining us tonight, is inevitably, well, joining us tonight, as always, is inevitably raring at the bit to get on that, chomping at the bit, raring to go. I'm mixing up my my terms there on AOS. We're also going to talk about 40K, even though Josh probably doesn't want to, because there have been some codexes, there have been some things happened. There might have even been a little bit of, well, I'm not going to call it controversy, because it was controversy for people for whom it really shouldn't have been, but anyway, carrying on. And we're also going to talk about Lord of the Rings, because we've been doing that, been playing that a lot, so that's fun. So yeah, joining me, ADR Wargaming, as always this evening, is, as I mentioned before, Mr. Josh the War Hipster. Say hello, Josh.
Get hype.
Get hype. Raise the roof. Put your hands in the air like you're ready for fourth edition. And also joining us is Mr. Jamie, the Sanguinary Punk. Say hello, Jamie.
Hello, Jamie.
There we go. And finally, the new Dwarven Master of Moria, and we'll get into why that is later. It is Mr. Gwotkin Gaming. It's Richard, everyone. Say hi, Richard.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. I like it. It's very smooth tones. It's quite nice. So, yes, we are once again assembled. So, look, guys, we spoke very briefly before we started recording about what we're going to talk about, and we have just got loads. So why don't we start with what I think is the biggie, and, you know, let's be honest, as I said, it's Mr. War
West Hipster. Coast versus East Coast hip hop.
Yeah, we're talking about Biggie and Tupac. This is actually a true crime podcast now. We're doing that. Next week we've got John Wayne Gacy and, you know, other murderers. No, we are. Let's start with the big one that has been, you know, confirmed. I think we all knew it was coming, but it's been confirmed since we last recorded, which is AOS 4. How exciting is that? How excited are you? Well, I mean, Josh, it's even worth asking how excited you are. It's like through the roof.
I'm like a coiled panther.
That's how I describe you to friends.
Yeah, a very overweight coiled panther, but
less of a pounce, more of a sort of gurning movement.
Yeah. I mean, look, one has to temper one's expectations all of the time, because that is the sensible thing to do. However, it's a great time to be alive. Especially after the disappointment of the previous 365 days from what people say is the bigger game system. I think the fact that 4 is coming, and of all the things that we've read so far, there's nothing to not like about it.
You made that sound like the Borg are on their way, though, when you said that 4 is coming. I don't know why, just immediately in my head it went there.
Resistance is futile.
Resistance to AOS is futile, Jamie. You know this, whatever. You've been playing with your Cities of Sigma,
not 4,
haven't you?
7's the nice one.
Listen, if Jerry Ryan in the catsuit wants to turn up and play AOS with us, I think we'd all be fine with that.
I think we would. No, I mean, honestly, it's I wasn't expecting an indexing. I really wasn't. I mean, I am on record as saying this.
You said it on here.
I don't think it was on here. It was on my channel, which is really embarrassing, because I've been through a series of live streams where I've been talking about it, and I have gotten it wrong pretty much every single time. So I was like, oh no, they won't index it, and I don't think they'll index it. The game's fine. Oh yeah, by the way, we're fully indexing the game. Oh great.
I'll tell you what, before you go on, I will say, listeners of the podcast who are fans of Josh's channel, and if you're not already a subscriber to Josh's channel, why not go and like and subscribe? Now is your opportunity to make a supercut, which you can drop to us by email, or if you're a member of Josh's channel, drop in the Discord, of just called Josh Gets AOS 4 Wrong, and it's just a supercut of you going, yeah, no indexing, followed by with the index and whatever else you've said.
I do have a soundboard that unfortunately doesn't work here, but I do have the Vine Boom. that I can play over everything. But like, yeah, I mean, it's, I did, like I said, I didn't expect them to index it. And to be honest, looking at the stuff that they've talked about in terms of indexing, it's not as, I think, groundbreakingly different as what the indexing has occurred in 40K. The last two indexing of 40K. You know, 7th to 8th was a mammoth shift. And whilst 9th to 10th, I think, was dressed as not being too much of a shift, in some ways it's not, and in some other massive glaring ways it really is. This time around, I think there's elements of, for Age of Sigmar, it's going to stick the landing much better than 40K's language, by the looks of it. So it's stuff like, they've said, yes, we're bringing in some universal special rules, but I think they said there's like seven.
Right.
Seven or nine or something. Seven of nine.
Yeah, it was definitely a smaller amount.
Yeah, much, much smaller amount. And I think they've, I think what they've done is, again, by the looks of things, they've labeled it in such a way which, if the idea is to simplify the game, don't give it an innocuous name. So like, they've gone for, it's like critical, it's like you got critical hits and you've got critical wounds in there.
Yeah, it's not like the sustained hits and whatnot, it's just not crits.
It's not sustained hits, lethal hits. I don't think there's such a thing as, I'm sure there will be something that says devastating wounds, but I think what we've seen so far is if something is going to do mortal damage, it says critical hit, mortal damage, or something like that, or critical wound, mortal damage, something like that.
Yeah, so, I mean, you could say some of the stuff is, like changing wounds to health is, seems like a very minor change, and why would you change it? But I think there is logic behind it, and from what I've seen from the previews so far, I've been fairly impressed by just the comprehension and like their ability to simplify stuff down so it's easier to understand, and all the color coding and symbols that they do. At first, I was like, this seems like a bit gimmicky, but actually reading through examples of War Scrolls, it's like, this actually improves comprehension. And I've, like I said, so far been impressed of how they've laid out the rules writing and organized it.
Would you say it's coming across as simplified, but not simple?
I knew that was
by chance.
Yeah.
Just easier to read.
So on that point about the color coding, what I think is really cool about it, and I noticed this in a codex that you and I were both looking at, Adam, the Custodes one. When we looked at the stratagems, they're supposed to be color coded, but what was it? It was battle tactic and strategic ploy.
Yes,
it's like three different knocks on the hex code marks different, and it's like they're basically the same. Like to my eye, and it's a color that you'll be shocked to hear. It's the area of the color spectrum that I struggle with. It's the greeny blue.
Yeah, probably not great. 40K has like a teal, a green, and a red, which if you're in the red-green color spectrum, there is no difference.
Exactly.
It's also not helped by the fact that the color palette doesn't actually indicate what type of stratagem it is.
No, it's generally it varies wildly at times.
Because like, I'm looking, for example, right now at the Codex Sages we were talking about, and there are strategic ploy stratagems. One of them is the green one, and the other one is the blue one.
So in 40K, I believe it's to do with when you use the stratagem.
Yeah.
However, they didn't explain that until about 3 to 6 months into the edition.
So, yeah. I think we've got into this. There's been a funny change in the waters, right? Where I think 40K was following AOS's lead, and I think if you believe that 40K was the trendsetter in the way the rules were written, that's silly. Because 8th edition is a rip off of, it's a straight rip from Age of Sigmar. Very little is different. There's just elements of 40K about it that are different for the sake of being different. So one I would point out is things like in Age of Sigmar, you don't call out the target of your charge. You just go, I'm going to attempt to charge move with these, and then you roll it. And then if you get whatever the amount you get is how far you can charge. if you can make engagement range, then you can do it. If you can't make engagement range, then you can't do it. Whereas 40k is you have to nominate a specific target that you have to go to, and if you fail that, you fail it completely. So the idea in Age of Sigmar is, of course, the one you want to get to is 12 inches away, but there's some birds 6 inches away that, you know, you can get into if that's better. So it's written in such a way that simplifies it. And so like with 40K's 8th edition, and that has been a rule ever since, is that you have to nominate the target of the charge, and if you fail the target of the charge, then you can't go. Same as if you want a multi-charge, you have to declare the multi-charge, and if you can't get to both, you fail it, even if one is 6 inches away and one is 7 inches away, but you roll a 6. So that's just different for the sake of being different. And I think it's like that didn't need to be different. There's obviously some things in Age of Sigmar that would never cross well into 40K, which were thankfully left out. Things like the priority roll. If somebody was able to take 2 turns of shooting at you, the game would be the worst game ever invented.
Well done. Your Eldar just got double turn.
Affects a game that much.
Yeah. So Age of Sigmar obviously came out, and I think, you know, it was weird and different. It's completely, completely different. It's the same level of change that 40K went through from 7th to 8th.
It definitely felt like when 8th edition came out that they had used the first edition of Age of Sigmar as not necessarily a testing bed for 40K rules, but that's kind of inevitably what happened, where 8th edition came out and it was a lot of the core mechanics from AOS, but like you said, slightly different.
And so I expected that pattern to continue, that any changes Age of Sigmar would make, you want to be across them because they will probably find their way into 40K. And it didn't happen. 9th edition didn't do that. 9th edition went down a very, very different route. And obviously then 3rd edition of, albeit I still think there's a bit of a,
there was definitely some cross-pollination between the two, but they started to diverge a bit more.
Well, yeah, I think the thing they focused on more above anything else was match play, competitive match play, and I think that's true of Age of Sigmar. The thing I found interesting is talking about this with my community and my audience when I've been live streaming is people have not really felt that change as much in Age of Sigmar, but it's very clearly there as well, because I think it's the smaller game and the game is so young as well. You're not used to 20 years of narrative being the only way you get your supplements, and then there's these two game systems, there's these two versions of playing Maelstrom and Eternal War, for example, and that'll do you for the next 5 years of the edition. Just enjoy it. And, you know, Age of Sigmar, as far as I'm aware, I could be completely wrong, Age of Sigmar's never had a frontline gaming ITC pack made for it because the game is fundamentally unplayable for that competitive reason, right?
I think there was, like, the only thing that I could think of that's similar was when the game first came out for Age of Sigmar, people wanted points so much that they came out with community points, and then GW released points that were somewhat based on it.
Yeah, and that was them correcting a mistake, because I think they genuinely thought at that point, let's just make a game that's fun, but also didn't really know what they were doing because it's completely brand new territory, and that's strange to say because, you know, I think they're very considered in how they do things usually.
Yeah. They were innovating because the game wasn't selling, so they were trying everything new and throwing stuff out there and, you know, finding out what didn't work.
Yeah, that's a very different time, right? So I expected Age of Sigmar to continue to set the trend, but it didn't. It moved in its own direction, and for my money's worth, for my 2 cents, I love 3rd. I think it's great. I really like it. I like the way it plays. I like the way it's balanced. It's bonkers. It always has been. Age of Sigmar has always been bonkers, and it's fantastic. I love it. I think the way the game plays out with how battle tactics and that work, I really like it. I like grand strategies as well. I do really enjoy those as a thing. They are sadly going, but I'm not going to miss them. You know, so I I had expected for Age of Sigmar to continue to set the trend. This time around, Edition feels like they've seen what 40K did and went, I think we can do a better job of that.
Yeah, I'd agree. There's definitely a lot of ideas taken from 10th ed 40K, and it seems like they've now been refined, and it feels like AOS 4 is kind of what 10th should have been.
And I think the interesting thing, I put this to the audience as well as you four, is the difference between Age of Sigmar and the difference between 40K is that 40K has been around for years, right? And it's never gone through an end times event. You know, there we can talk about Age of Sigmar as being a successor to fantasy battles, but it's not really. I mean, it is in the timeline, but it's not really. You're not. It's become. It has taken the last 9 years, but it is. I feel like at this point, it is almost entirely out of fantasy battles' shadow, and it is completely its own.
Well, especially with Old World coming back as well.
Yeah.
Because the rules are different enough, and now after 10 years of mod releases, they can actually separate the ranges out and here are Old World models and here are Age of Sigmar models. They can now be two separate games.
Much to some people's chagrin, we should say, to be fair. Beast of Chaos players.
Big asterisks of this, like, we've only seen so much of the rules, it could still be terrible in the end, but what we've seen so far is very promising.
It's very good, yeah.
Yeah. And so the thing I think with Age of Sigmar, because it is so young, and, you know, like, there are obviously people out there with massive collections. I myself am somebody who has a massive collection of Age of Sigmar models. But when the changes as we've seen them, so I'll point to, and this the similarity here is, you know, in 40K you have the detachments system, right? And Age of Sigmar is going for, it's like regimental tactics or something. It's basically the detachment system. I can't remember its exact word.
Regiments. Name.
Well, funnily enough, regiments
are how
to
you
me
build the army. It's the army rule that you choose, right? Previewed the
Stormcast.
Because
I was going to say regiments actually feels more like Middle Earth and Lord of the Rings, where it's hero leading troops.
Yeah. So what you have is you have the, you know, if you're Stormcast Eternals, you can pick from these four things, and these will give you the things in the way that the army fights. The reason I'm going to use a very provocative word here, but the reason I feel betrayed by 40K but not by Age of Sigmar is because my collection of 40K models is enormous, and I made choices based on my favorite things on how I want them to be. And now 40K says to me, doesn't really matter anymore, does it? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I've definitely not necessarily felt betrayed by it, but armies haven't felt quite as fluffy to me, and that does actually detract from the game. Like, it's, and I was thinking about that earlier today with the, because it came up in the Age of Sigmar article, funnily enough, was the idea that, you know, how you paint your army doesn't matter to how the rules are. Great in concept. But I do think that 40K went maybe a bit too far with that, where if you went to a tournament, you know, previously you could face like 6-10 Space Marine players, whatever, and they would all have different rules. And while it's nice to be able to choose the rules that you want to play, if you go to a tournament and there is only one detachment that's considered the best, then you're going to play that same detachment 6 times in a row instead of 6 different detachments.
Yeah,
part of that is balance of detachments.
I can completely understand that, but I think I think the counterpoint to it probably, certainly on the 40K basis, is that, to be frank, actually, I don't think it's that extreme at all. So if you go to the majority of the tournaments at the moment and face a bunch of Marine players, I think it's probably better than it was at the end of 9th, to be completely frank. That's so end of 9th, I went to a hell of a lot of tournaments end of 9th. I think I did about 7 in the last 6 months. And, I mean, you couldn't get Dark Angels and Space Wolves and Iron Hands off the table for a start. And the Space Wolf and the Iron Hands builds were actually the same. Space Wolves were basically doing a successor version that allowed them to explode in sixes, and then they essentially did Desolation Marine. Yeah,
well, you never actually saw a proper Space Wolves detachment.
Yeah, they did the same thing as the Iron Wolf, as the Iron Hands guys did, and then the Dark Angels build was very fluffy Dark Angels, but my God, it was shit to play against. And that was kind of it. Like, you know, there were other chapters flying about doing their thing, but, you know, largely only on kind of bottom and middle tables, like myself with Bangles, in fairness. But now if you go down, I think actually you'll find, certainly when I was looking through what was at Oxford, a bunch of Sanguineous, there was Firestorm with myself and a couple of other guys, there was a bunch of Ironstorm, there was a bunch of Gladius, there was a bunch of Stormlands.
That's really encouraging to hear.
And that's really, the Marine decks, honestly, is getting, if you look at the Metamunda reports and stuff like that, there is some internal balance difference there. Like I say, at the moment of the main Marine decks, certainly, you know, Space Wolves run Stormlands really well, and they're the only ones that do. Unfortunately for White Scars, that's more of a problem about unit strength and so on. But Firestorm is pretty popular. Ironstorm is super popular and playing on easy mode, a lot of people say, but it only wins about the same as the rest, and the representation's not as fast as you think.
Yeah.
But actually, I think they've done a really good job with it. So I think... For me, at least anyway, being sat in 40k at the moment, and it definitely didn't look like it was going to be this way, I don't think, and especially not with the main decks. And it's not the same with all dexes. Dabeg and probably Custodes to come and a few others. But I think actually there is probably, for me, as much if not more variance than there was. I think it just took a little while to settle in. And if you just looked at what were the winning lists in the first couple of weeks of that Codex launching, it wasn't indicative of what was going to happen when it breathed life. But what I think that means for Sigmar is that I think if the similar kind of things coming in with the detachment styles, brilliant, absolutely brilliant. I really have
choosing your army style, it's been really great. So my Tyranids aren't a specific faction, so I can choose what feels the fluffiest for me to play for that faction, and you know, I can unswitch around it if I need to, but I think the other part of it was the lack of restrictions. Like just being able to pick whatever you want, basically, and not having to tie into those restrictions. Army-less building can be kind of a bit of a puzzle.
Yeah,
trying to solve and get the best.
So, like, Rich, sorry to cut across you, I was going to say, so for example, would you be an. We should get, for going into 40k, I get that, the differences.
We'll jump back.
So would you, for example, make the argument I have seen others make where you say, well, actually, Dark Angels shouldn't be able, or Blood Angels, or Space Wolves, or Black Templar, anybody that has their own supplement, for example, shouldn't be able to take the main Space Marine detachment. They should only get what's in their book. Is that?
No, it's less briefly. That. It's more unit choices.
Right.
I think my favorite way of building an army in 40k has actually been the really old combined arm detachment, where you go, here's, you have two HQ choices, three troops, etc., etc. But for example, you've made a point previously about leaders almost feeling like they're sergeants because everyone's just taking them to buff their squads up because that's the optimal way to buff the squads.
Yep.
But if you could only take like two leaders, then that problem isn't as prevalent.
The Space Marines is a funny one. I think it's the most difficult one to talk about because it is the one that is like, well, I mean, yeah, you should be able to do anything really with them, but also maybe there should be restrictions and this, that, and the other. But there's stuff like, for me, I feel like I said, when I make my armies, I very actively choose them to be a certain way, and I want to be rewarded and punished at the same time for making that choice. So, like, a great example, I think, is the 8th edition into 9th edition Demons Codex. Now, the 8th edition Demons Codex was like really like, if you're gonna devote yourself to one god here, you're gonna get all of these things. If you mix it up, you're not gonna get all of those things, and if you do this, you're not gonna get that thing either. Whereas now you just take a general mess of whatever the hell, and it's like, okay, cool. So like, and then there's also things like, you know, we've seen it in Tau. You could have a gigantic Viola army, which you love, or a Sasaeor army or whatever. Now you can just, or Viola is probably the best one, or Tau Empire is probably the best example of that. And you've got Shadow Sun and this, that, and the other. Now you just buy Commander Farsight and throw him in as well, because you're no longer restricted to just being a Farsight Enclaves or Tau Empire thing. Which
I think it's like the no consequences to that.
Yes.
Kind of bugs me a bit.
Yeah, and there is one restriction in the Tau Codex in that you can't take Ethereals and Farsight in the same army. And you go, that's fine, because Ethereals are crap, and so are Fire Warriors, and Battle Suits are great, so I'm just going to take Farsight. Of course I am. So, you know, it is what it is. But to get back on track with Age of Sigmar, and the point I'm making, I'd be interested to hear what the community has to say about this as well, is that it's never really mattered to me as much in that, because it is so fresh and new to me, because it's still really young. It's not that. It's 9 years old now, or 10 years old, maybe. It's at least nine, or it's approaching nine, because it's got its fourth edition coming. But I've got multiple different Storm Hosts and multiple different Grand Courts. And for my Flesh Eater Courts, and I've got multiple different painted Slaves to Darkness, Chaos Warriors and stuff like this. I haven't gone for a uniform thing, because it's felt fine. Whereas I grew up in 40K, and this is the point I'm making, because of its longevity, I grew up in 40K being pick one, that's your one, and that's how you play. And now that's not the case. And to me, that makes me feel like I'm unanchored.
In a candy store.
isn't that the balance that we got as well, though, in 40? Well, and when I say fundamental balance, I don't mean rules balance here whatsoever. I'm meaning rather an imbalance of experience. And it's always similar with WYSIWYG stuff as well, right?
Mm.
In AOS, as you say, it doesn't matter too much, because they're less... feels like that lore's probably not as ingrained, and certainly the you know, the choice of color scheme might not be as ingrained. Similarly, in 40K, the choice of color scheme is kind of really only that relevant for those factions where people are super familiar with them. So Space Marines by a mile, Chaos Space Marines by a mile, and then after that, maybe Nids, maybe, because we're quite, the High Fleet's been reasonably well established, but I'll be honest, I've played Nids, and I can barely ever remember which one is Leviathan and which one is Behemoth. Then with other stuff, like
Eldar Necrons, as well, maybe.
Nobody's ever given a crap with Necrons. Eldar's kind of fortunate in that the majority of stuff isn't actually painted after the craft world, unless you're actually playing, you know, reasonably fluffy, but you know, but there's a bunch of stuff, and yeah, you're right, that's probably another one. But Tau, nobody's ever really worried, nobody ever really bothers. The only factions that have ever been hit by that have been locked into a play style and a sub faction each edition by your collection, and also because so many of their unique characters and units and so on, which is a luxury of the faction, but nonetheless it's a thing, is basically Marines and Chaos Space Marines, right? Everything else, you've pretty much had as much freedom as you want. Nobody was going to pull you up for it.
I would say maybe more like earlier editions before 8th Guard potentially fell into that as well, but that's because they had sort of separate model ranges for each of those factions.
Unique units again. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it used to really confuse me when, in 8th edition in particular, when I would be playing against Guard, and they were all clearly Cadians, but I was told they were Catajans. And I was like, those aren't Catajans, though. Those are Cadians. It's like, no, I'm playing them as Catajans. It's like, okay, I get it. But the Catajans have a flipping model range. Like, it's not like you're telling me these are the Praetorian Guard, who no longer have a model range. You can still buy Catajans. Don't tell me these aren't Catajans. Let me say, oh yeah, sorry, no, this Space Marine army that you see before you, it's not actually a Space Marine army. This is Tau. They're clearly not Tau. They're clearly not Space Marines. And those are clearly Cadians. They're not Catajans.
bringing it back to AOS.
Yes.
It's all important stuff, right? And I get what you're saying, Josh and Rich and Jamie. But I mean, clearly, obviously, we're excited about it. We know it's coming. It's looking good. I agree. The way they've presented the rules thus far has been very communicable, I think it's very easy to kind of read and very easy to understand, which is great. And a lot of people are getting into it. What is, and obviously Josh primarily directed at you as the veteran AOS player, but, you know, Rich, I know you're looking at getting into maybe bits of AOS. And Jamie, obviously you have your Sigmar that you've been sort of slowly working on building up. Like, one thing each. And if you say the same thing, it's fine. But, like, what's been the thing so far that you've looked at and you've gone, yeah, do you know what, actually, that's my favourite thing? And it can be anything. It can be a model. It can be, a rule thing. Because they've shown us a few models as well. It can be, like, a rules thing. It can just be, like, the presentation of it. Like, whatever you want. Like, genuinely, free reign. So, Josh, we'll start with you, naturally, I think, just because you are you're the veteran. So, what's, like, the one thing out of all that you've seen, you've gone, yeah, that's really cool, and that's the thing I like the most? So
all of it.
You can't, other than saying all of it, I'm going to stop you there.
Never, I can't pick one thing. Like, yeah. it's been a case of cumulativeness. Yeah, and like I said, I had worries before that maybe things like the double turn would go.
Mm.
It's not gone. It's staying.
Yeah.
They've
made it more impactful, right? About if you choose.
They have.
Am I right in saying, and if I get this wrong, audience and Josh, whoever else wants to correct me, do wrong. Am I right in saying now, if you do the double turn, if you pick to go first twice, you can't do battle tactics. You're basically giving up a section of points that you can get in the turn.
That is correct.
That's really good.
Yeah.
In terms of balancing it.
You also, because they've talked about this underdog mechanic, not only will you be, so the underdog mechanic is if you're losing, you unlock certain benefits. To your army, and it'll change per battle pack, and it might change per mission or whatever, but they have talked briefly about this underdog mechanic. So if you take the double turn, you go second and then first. If you take the double turn, you will
second,
not be able to score your battle tactics, which for the uninitiated are secondaries.
Yeah, I was going to say, for 40k players, yeah, secondaries.
You won't be able to score secondaries. You're also probably likely handing your opponent the underdog, because you'll presumably, if you're going to do it, because double turn is always going to be very powerful.
Yeah,
it's always going to be very powerful. And that's the thing is like, you can trade off scoring points and whatever these underdog benefits are. They might have covered some of them in detail. I just can't remember them.
I think you get an extra command point per battle round.
Extra command point, and I think there's also a command trait, command ability they've talked about as well. And there's also other, there'll definitely be other stuff as well that will be involved in. And there was an article they did about the battle plans, about how you score in the game, and in there it also talked about the underdog mechanic per battle plan. So some specific scenarios you might actually not, you'll take the advantage of being able to maneuver twice and shoot twice and fight first twice in a row. But if you're giving up scoring points plus an extra command point plus whatever the underdog mechanic might be for that particular battle plan, that's a big decision to make.
There's more reactions, so that it's not like you're just doing, you know, have two turns of you doing stuff. The opponent can actually act in both of those turns.
Yeah. So
yeah.
There's things like, there is the counter charge that has been talked about as a reaction command ability that you can do. Well, when your opponent, I think it's in the movement and the charge phase, where your opponent makes a move or a charge, you can then do that, and you can then yourself make a charge. So you'll get all the benefits of charging. It's not a heroic intervention. It's not anything like that. It is a counter charge. So you'll roll your 2d6. So you might go, hey, you've charged me here with this thing, but my chariot's there. And I think there is a range restriction on it. But it might be that you cut down the supporting character that's behind with the chariot by countercharging with the chariot that way, and so on and so forth. So there's all of that that has been really, really bloody exciting. And like I said, you always have worries going into these things, like, you know, is the combat phase going to change? Is the shooting phase going to change? Was magic going to go like psychic did in 40k? Nope. It's all still there. And they keep going, hey, look, here's this thing. that you guys might be interested in. And I keep going, sick. I'm basically choosing to ignore anxiety. And like I said, that you have to take things with a pinch of salt. Of course you do, because right now the only source of information is from the marketing arm of the company that wants to sell you the game. Of course that is the case.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of hype for 10th edition and it looked amazing. And then the further we got into it, we then found some problems with it. And it's still like a really fun game to play, but yeah, obviously the marketing is very effective.
I had this exact conversation the other day with a friend of mine, and I recalled, because he was like, you weren't critical at all of it before 10th came out. And I was like, actually, there was a 2-hour, I want to say close to an argument I had with Adam, where I said that Battleshock is always going to... No, I think it was with all four of us, actually.
Yeah.
I said Battleshock phase looks dumb, it's stupid, and it never works in the games. And everyone at the time was saying, oh no, it's really powerful now, it's going to change things. Has it? No. And it's so much so, and Adam, do you know what?
Sometimes can change a game, but it's...
Yep, I, and also for the faction that mainly use it, NIDS, it's genuinely brilliant. At times. Yeah. At times.
Well, the point I was going to make was, I think if I had to pick one thing from everything that's fantastic, Age of Sigmar has clearly said, morale is just a waste of time because they've got rid of it. Morale phase.
Yeah, I did see
that. They're just like,
you know what? We've never got this rule right. Let's just get rid of it.
Exactly.
It never makes sense.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, like, I'm just like, yeah, great. I mean, is the idea, like the idea of a bravery bomb is fantastic. You go, yeah, never I love worked. The idea of bravery bombs. Or like, and even in 8th and 9th edition, you go, oh, you could make a bravery bomb here where you make people fail things. And then you go, hang on, what's this about the Chaos Demon secondaries only being able to score off of people failing leadership tests, which they don't do?
Yeah.
So, you know, it is what it is.
The problem with Battleshock is, you, in order to make it like effective, you just need to stack it to the point that it becomes like very difficult. Like the NIDS one really works, like, because you have that, what is it, the Nero Tyrant on the field that gives you the additional -1.
Yeah.
And then you've got
any form of Battleshock or Morale Bomb that's existed over the years in 40K
stacked
is all about stacking it to the extent that it will have a big impact. Because you're always making, it's always an opportunity cost to choosing these abilities where you're choosing to do this instead of doing just straight damage. And in some editions, like there was a Drukhari version that really worked well back in, I think, 7th edition. But it's always this opportunity cost. And can you get it to that level where it will have such a big impact on the game that the points that you haven't invested in damage will actually come across in the advantage you get from the morale failures and whatnot. And in previous editions of the game, there's been ways to auto-pass to the extent that it hasn't been worth it, or there haven't been enough stacking buffs to get you to that level. I think NID not really do it. Like, my NIDs mostly focus on more damage, and if I get some nice Battleshock, that's fine. But you can build them in the way to lean into Battleshock because there's more tangible benefit from Battleshock. But yeah, most armies don't need to.
Yeah, the needs one also works, I think, better than others because A, you force it when you want, and B, you do it on, like, it just has a higher chance of succeeding for you as the NID player or them failing because everybody has to roll.
I would say it's Battleshock is, while, yeah, Josh, it's probably not as impactful for a lot of armies, it's definitely better than we've had in 8th and 9th, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's better. But that's because in eighth and ninth, it was negligible.
Yeah, but it does tell you something that AOS has got. Like, I agree, Josh. And you know, on this point, like, my poor Chaos Knights, a lot of their mechanics work off Battleshock. And it's like, you know, again, compared to the NIDs being able to just force it on everything, it's like the Chaos Knights, if you have one knight wandering about that might be able to force it on the unit next to it, it's just like, oh, But yeah. Moving on.
You also have, like, as counter to it, you also have an entire army faction in the form of... I've watched a lot of Chaos Space... I didn't realize how many Chaos Space Marines videos I've watched, but I've actually watched quite a few. And in it, they've only ever done mortal wounds to themselves, like, 4 times.
Oh, what, by failing the Dark Pact?
Exactly. And I'm like, so there's a whole thing there that keys off of leadership. Maybe I haven't watched enough Chaos Space Marines versus Tyranids to really throw me on the... to really sell me on the Battleshock thing, but yeah, as I said, but like, yeah, I'm just honestly, I mean, that's a really long answer to your question, Adam, but I'm just not worried. I'm just flat not worried. And even in the face of things like the Legends miniatures and stuff like that, I don't think that was communicated particularly well by Games Workshop. But then at the same time, it's like some of it's going to come back, and then also it's. Have you ever heard of a proxy? Just use the old models if you're really upset about it.
Also, they're legends. You can still use those models, and they'll be supported for a year. And after that,
they're around
you can still use
anyway.
Them, just not at like official competitions or whatnot.
Which, again, takes me back to that point of, you remember when it was announced that there was going to be legends, like all of Forge World was being legends in 10th edition?
Yeah.
So all the Leviathan Dreadnoughts and all that. Basically, that article came out and went, oh yeah, by the way, from the day Leviathan comes out, none of these are valid anymore.
Yeah, and I think it was especially egregious because, like, a couple of months previously, they just released, like, new plastic Leviathan Dreadnought. These can be used in your 40k games. People went out and bought a whole lot of them, and then a couple months later, they were like, oh yeah, by the way, you can't use them anymore. There was, like, no transition period.
Yeah, so I think... Like I said, to go back to my point about how Age of Sigmar, I think, has looked at what 40k has done and has gone, yeah, we can do that much better. In that communication of the things that have been legend, they went, oh, and these will all still be valid for competitive play until 2025. So you're getting an extra year out of your miniatures, which, again, is not like it's not a reason.
It's also
going to
take that long to just start releasing all the army books as well.
Yeah. But like I said, it's not a reason to not be annoyed, but they're not gone. Not yet.
What's also interesting is that they actually said in the article that they're going to continue to balance them, which is the first time they've ever said that. So, I mean, a couple of conversations with them in general. I mean, unfortunately, the Orc Codex has legended my absolute favourite model in my Orc army, which is the Squiggoth. But and my plan for that, because... I don't get a chance to use Legends that often because I don't actually play many pickup games these days, is that I'm going to convert him into stick him on a wagon, right? But similarly, that actually if you wanted to use him, it's a perfectly well-balanced data sheet as it is, but in 40K, they're not going to continue to balance it. What was really interesting in that article, and I don't know whether it's a mistype, but it's the typical Warcom doesn't quite get something right. But the fact it said they'll continue to balance them throughout the edition was super interesting. Because at that point, I mean, you could say it calls into question why the hell they're even legends to a certain extent. But certainly it means that it's a decision that's not been driven by purely by kind of, if you like, match play. It's been driven by something else. They want to hive these things off somewhere else for a different reason. But we'll... similarly be in a good place for you to be able to play a well-balanced game of AOS that does feature those units.
Yeah.
But again, we'll see how that actually looks. I just found it very, it was quite fascinating to me that they put that in there, because that's normally, that is the clause. That's the reason that something goes to Legends. They're not going to continue to get points updates.
Yeah.
They are going to continue to get them. That's super interesting.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. Okay. Well, on that note, Jamie, why don't you, of what you've seen, if anything, because I know you've been quite busy, what's your sort of thing so far that you've seen from AOS that you're thinking, ooh, that tickles my fancy?
So I'm going to be really crap here and say very little. Not because it doesn't look good, just I haven't bothered looking, because...
It's fair enough.
To be frank, I am not getting sucked into what we did with 40K of it being part of my daily life for 3 months talking about every reveal that we get on it. And I enjoy this discussion very much. I've enjoyed some of the points made by Josh in particular. But I'm just kind of staying away from it until it comes and just thinking, I'm just going to build my cities have them there. I am really looking forward to being a beginner in a game again, and not hosting lots of beginner events trying to tell people how to learn the new edition, but rather going, I'm going to go to somebody else's event and learn how to play the edition.
That's cool.
So that's, I genuinely am really excited for it, but I've slightly consciously just stayed away from it because, yeah, with 10th, I think all my enthusiasm for talking about rules before they came out has been drained away. But I will listen to people via podcasts and stuff like that once we get a bit closer.
Are you working on your spearhead?
Is the spearhead, that's the, like the combat patrol effectively, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
The Cities of Vanguard or whatever it is. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The Cities of Sigma one is really quite good.
Really, I like fucking it annoying because I bought all the component parts to it before I actually before it got announced. So that box came out and I literally just went, "You bastards!" I bought all of those things, literally in the exact number to complement the box that.
I did exactly the same thing
from Adam originally, the army box.
Yeah,
so it's just kind of annoying that at least one thing they have done in bloody 40k is they bring up the combat patrol with the sodding or renounce it with the codex. So the fact that was 3 months after the army book was a little frustrating.
I did exactly the same thing with Flesh Eater Courts.
But I mean, what will be interesting there as well, though, is whether those I would imagine because the city's vanguard's so close to. Fourth, that it will remain the same, but obviously the combat patrols in 40k have all been changing, and what that's led to is actually, you know, several factions have actually got two combat patrol rules that you can pick from because they are actually keeping the rules from the old boxes as well, which is really cool. The combat patrol itself has been phenomenal in 10th. It's been one of the best introductions. It makes for the easiest beginner nights and the most brilliant casual nights for me to run a regular base that are super, super popular, including the new White Dwarf rules that have been for like 3 and 4 player games as well, which have been really madcap and really fun. If Vanguard follows the same trend as that, that's going to be really interesting to me because I want to keep AOS as a completely casual, really fun thing. And that will involve playing 2K games. I'm right bang up for that. But playing Vanguard, if it is as good as Combat Patrol is going to be the way that I go about learning that edition. And yeah, I am definitely working up those units first. Even though I'm dying to do the big, I can't remember her name, but the big Griffin woman who is absolutely
Tiny Aventra, the lioness of the
I've
punch.
Built it and I'm resisting doing it because I'm just like, no, Jamie, you're not going to use that to learn the new edition. But it's big and it's and it looks lovely.
It's a beautiful model, isn't it? I don't blame you. I mean, I do this every time when I go, oh, I'm going to start a new AOS army. And like on the point of Spearhead and Vanguard, I have been in the last sort of fortnight been procuring all of the bits so that once AOS 4 comes out, I should have 10 of the Vanguards and Spearheads ready to go so that I can just be like, who wants to play some Age of Sigmar, baby? Yeah, I've been because I have I've accumulated a huge amount of Age of Sigmar stuff over the years, and so when I was looking at it, I was like, if all the Vanguards are going to be usable in Spearhead, and all the Spearheads are obviously we've only got 3 of them at the moment, I was like, what do I need like out of all of these just to kind of finish some bits off? And I was like, well, for that faction, I need one model, and for this one, I need 2, and for that one, I need 1 model, and that one's already finished, and this one has. I was like, do you know what I'm just going to do? I'm just going to do all of it. So, like, for example, my Maggotkin of Nurgle, the Maggotkin of Nurgle Vanguard set, the only thing I haven't done yet is Spoilpox Scrivener. So I'm like, well, I guess I'm going to paint my Spoilpox Scrivener.
I will say what's interesting, Josh, that you mentioned there, we only have 3 spearheads at the moment. We actually have, so I while you were talking, and also not to bury the lead, but Rich, have we spoiled what your favorite thing might be by any chance by talking about spearheads? Because you were enthusiastic about it the other day.
There might be some cross pollination there,
but there are actually a large number of, and they are very much repackaged Vanguards, but interestingly maybe it does give us an idea of what's going to change versus what isn't, because the following are all labeled as spearhead on Warhammer ogremorebeacon.com on the shop, which is Eidneth Deepkin, Ogre Moor Tribes, Gloomspite Gits, Soulblight Gravelords, Ossiarch Bone Reapers, Sylvaneth, Flesh Eater Courts, Stormcast obviously was one of the ones they announced, so we know that. Auric Warclans, again, same way. Auric Warclans is still a Vanguard. And then the other Vanguards are Fire Slayers, Lumineth Realm Lords, Disciples of Tzeentch, Daughters of Cain, Night Haunt, Slaves to Darkness, Head of Knights of Sunesh, Blades of Khorne, Cadron Overlords, and that's all they've got in stock.
Where are you seeing that? How have you got to that?
This is on the Start Here page. So it's normally, if you go to Age of Sigmar and Start Here, they've got like a selection of the beginner boxes. It's quite interesting.
Another interesting one there as well. I didn't hear you say Seraphon. I'm not sure that's because they might be out of stock.
No, so Seraphon is not actually listed on here, which is quite funny. And I don't know. I won't go to the Seraphon page.
I think they were listed as Vanguard last time I checked, but they were used heavily in the Spearhead promotional materials and like videos and such.
Well, I mean, I have Vanguard Seraphon sitting to my left, and I'm currently building painting up the remaining bits of Vanguard Eidoneth Deepkin, which helpfully is the same as what is listed on here as Spearhead Eidoneth Deepkin. So that makes me happy.
Yeah, that is interesting. I do think, because I've been staring at this. So yeah, Spearhead Cities of Sigmar, I've done it. Spearhead Stormcast Eternals, 5 models and I've done it. Spearhead Flesh Eater Courts, I've done it. Spearhead Sylvaneth, I need to paint a branch witch. That was called Vanguard Sylvaneth when I was looking at this literally 2 days ago.
I need to paint this guy, Josh, which I'm currently holding up.
I think next week's article, which may be out by the time this goes live, is supposed to be on Spearhead, I think. So we'll find out more about it in the future.
That's the Spirit of Durthu that you're holding.
I know.
The one in the box is a Tree Lord.
I know, but I'm just going to pretend he's a Tree Lord.
I can send you a Tree Lord. I have a spare one.
You got a spare Tree Lord?
Yeah. I was hunting for my branch witch. I knew I had one. And I was like, I found my box, which has got all my spare Sylvaneth. And in there is 20 Dryads, 9 Kurnoth Hunters, and a Tree Lord.
Nice.
All on sprue. So I can send you a Tree Lord. Because I already have a Tree Lord. Because I'm an absolute Age of Sigmar fanboy.
I have a Tree Lord Ancient somewhere, as well as a Spirit of Durthu. I think the one I'm missing is the regular Tree Horde. Tree Lord, not Tree Horde. He's like hoarding trees.
Yeah. Okay, so yes, some of these have changed name, because they weren't called Spearhead before.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
It's interesting.
The Seraphon one, for those interested, is a Carnosaur on Saurus Old Blood on Carnosaur. 10 Saurus Warriors and 3 Croxigore. It's not very expansive. I bought a Chaos Chariot and a Chaos Lord so I could finish my Slaves to Darkness one. I bought a Vanguard Lumineth set because I needed some bits for that. Trying to source a Knight of Shrouds for the Vanguard Night Haunt. Not the one on horse, but the one on foot. Because Alice has done most of Vanguard Night Haunt, and I bought her some Grimghast Reapers, but the only thing we haven't got is a Knight of Shrouds.
You know what?
I might
have one that I picked up in like an eBay lot, so let me have a double check.
Yeah, it's the one on foot, not on horse. Yeah, Soulblight Gravelords. I've got the box. I've got the Vanguard box. Like I said, I've got 10. I need to do a Beast Skewer Killbow as well. So I'm ready. I'm raring to go.
I love Cruel Boy's names. Man Skewer Bolt Boys, Beast Killer, Beast Skewer Killbow. It's great.
Yeah, I love the Man Skewers.
The Man Skewers.
Just because Man Skewer Bolt Boys sounds like a club.
Yeah. There's lots of leather in that club. So, Rich, we might have, as I say, buried the lead a bit here, but like Spearhead, I presume, was one of the things you were excited about based on what you were talking about yesterday.
In a sort of a broader sense. So for me, it's how easy it is to buy into the new edition.
Nice.
Which is basically, yeah, so Spearhead is a great buy-in because it's buy this one box and then you're in. But it's also to do with the modularity of the rules that they mentioned. The fact that,
yeah,
this is kind of true with Combat Patrol and 40k as well, but it's a case of you buy this one box, you read the core rules, and don't worry about anything else. Don't worry about all the month, like the quarterly updates or the, you know, 6 month updates. Don't worry about the battle tactics and the grand strategies and none of that. Just core rules, box, go.
Yeah. It's not, yeah, it does seem like a great way to get going and say, I've and, been
Yeah, because I've been doing Josh's similar situation. I've been working on as Jamie, where I'm interested in playing it in a casual manner. I probably won't go up to the whole tournament level. I'm sure once I start playing it at a spearhead level, I'll inevitably expand out to a 2,000 point army. But then that'll kind of, you know, be it. I'll collect 2,000 to 4,000 points, and then I'll just play some casual games every now and then.
Nice.
Skaven.
Skaven, yeah.
Look, if Launchbox has great models, they're a consideration.
I mean, I'll be the one set. I my favorite, because you've all covered, I agree with Josh, it's kind of everything I'm excited about, but you've covered all some of the key points. I think I will be the one to say some of the new models look dead cool. The Reclusians are the one I'm thinking of, because I just love the fact they have an emotional support grandchild following them around. I just think the lore behind that is fantastic. They just said yes, you're my great grandchild, or cousin, great grand cousin or something once removed, and you're here to remind me not to go completely insane, or at the very least not to completely lose my humanity. For people who haven't seen, the Reclusians are one of the new Stormcast units. I say one of, because presumably there will be others, and they are basically the ones that are in the trailer. They're these big armored kind of people with axes and shields, and they just look absolutely baller. And in the lore, they are basically Stormcast that have been reborn many, many, many times. They have loads of experience. And the trailer, I will say, I'll say this is my other favorite thing for this. The trailer for AOS 4 was dead cool, because you got to see the character in it, the woman who becomes a Reclusian. You got to see her when she was, a human, a mortal champion. She gets killed by some chaos, some Tzeentch goatmen. What are they called? Zangors.
Yeah.
She's killed by some Zangors, and that's first edition AOS. Then you see her fighting some ghosts, and that's
before she was a Stormcast.
Yeah, that's before she's a Stormcast. She gets killed,
and then Chaos.
There's a great shot of Nagash kind of holding her soul in her hand, about to go, and then she gets zapped away by Sigmar and turned into this Stormcast Eternal. Then she's fighting ghosts. She's fighting Nighthaunt, and she gets blapped around the head by one of them, and she dies, and she goes back up and gets reforged. Then she gets killed by Nurgle, and it's it's second edition. And then, it's AOS 1, then 2, then 3, you've got she gets killed by a cruel boy. And it's really cool, because you see her progression as a Stormcast as well, because when she gets, she's killed by the others, pretty horrible, it's pretty violent, she dies. When she gets killed by the cruel boy, literally, they stab her in the back, she just turns and looks at them for a second before, exploding in lightning and going back up to be reforged. And then the whole idea is, because they've been reforged so many times, they're basically losing touch with who they are. They're just becoming these kind of, they're not automatons, but they are fighters, and all they know is war. They don't remember who they were in a past life. And that's the whole Sigmar lied tagline. It's, this idea that you get immortality, but you're still who you were. It's you're not actually, you lose it, because you lose a bit of your soul each time you get reforged.
Yeah.
But still they fight on. And in the models, they are accompanied by, you don't see them in the trailer, but in the models, they're accompanied by a mortal descendant of theirs, who is basically following them around, reminding them of who they are, were their champ, their noble nature. So they're not just these kind of sort of, savage killing machines, for good, but still pretty dark, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're the ones that have decided to go and kill some rats. So if you've watched Always Sunny in Philadelphia, they're Charlie Day with his rat whacking stick. And he's going to kill some rats. That's basically what they are, and I think that's really cool.
I thought it was the best trailer they've made.
It was pretty awesome. I will say the Horus Heresy introductory trailer was pretty good.
That one was good.
The 40k one with the Necrons and Space Marine Guard, sisters,
yeah,
all that was very cool. But yeah, this one was also very good.
I'll concede that as well, but I thought this one was genuinely, objectively, I've tried to be objective as well.
You can't be objective.
No,
about
no, no. I thought this one was the best one they'd made, yeah, by far and away, better than the Leviathan one.
Yeah, it was. I thought it was better animated.
It also,
yeah, I would say
made up for the,
yeah,
absolute
on par
travesty
with the old
that was the third edition trailer.
Yeah, the AOS 3 trailer was pretty poor.
It was rubbish. And also, as well, I have felt let down in the past by how they launched AOS 3, in that it felt like someone somewhere made a decision that they didn't really care. So it just sort of came out. Because if you compare and contrast the way AOS 3 started to be previewed with how 40k 10th, 40k 8th, 40k 9th, how all of them were previewed, it was like, oh, come on. Like, even so much as you'll recall, Sotrum cast Eternals.
Oh, yeah, they spelled it wrong, didn't they?
Yeah, they spelled it wrong. And at no point did they acknowledge it either. It was like, if you're not even going to pay close enough attention to the PowerPoint slide, that in large capital letters it says Sotrum cast Eternals rather than Storm cast Eternals. They were previewing Yvraine as well. Like, they were just going straight off with the... Not Yvraine. What's it called? What's her name?
Yndrasta.
Yndrasta, the celestial spear.
Yvraine's an elven lady with a cat.
Yeah. So they were literally just going, here's the best model in the box. Who cares?
Yeah.
And it was like, don't do that. That's not fair. And so this time around, I've just been like, do you know what? You've made up for my past wound. Because, like I said, it is my favorite thing, and I know that is counter to most of you. And sometimes it's difficult, right, when all you want to do is talk and play and muck about with Age of Sigmar, but a Munitorum Field Manual came out, so that's the only thing anyone cares about. And so sometimes you sit with conversations that, like, when we hang out or whatever, or all this kind of thing, it's like, I really want to just talk about this thing none of you care about, but all of you care about this one thing. So it's like, okay.
But Josh, you've made us care about AOS, and look, here we are talking about AOS.
Yeah, I am Samus of this group when it comes to AOS.
I mean, I did the same thing with Middle-earth.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you've both had a pernicious and frankly evil influence on my hobby collecting. look, I think, just to kind of round it out, I think we are obviously we're all excited for AOS 4. I think even, you know, and then Jamie, you said you're deliberately not paying attention to it because you kind of want to stay out of it until we've got the full details and do you kind of spearhead focus and that kind of thing. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a new game system. It looks really good. So, you know, let's see where it goes. And, you know, I will say, audience listeners, we are recording this on a Sunday night, so we will get a new model presumably tomorrow as well, because every Monday is new model Monday.
And it will be a new Stormcast as well, because last time it was a Skaven, so I'll have to, I'll be
your loins.
I'll be checking out the nearest campsites to pitch my tent.
Yeah, because we had the Warlock Engineer the other week, which was the Skaven guy who looks awesome. And you know what? Look, Skaven players, happy news for Skaven players, because, you know, one of those factions that is cool is really old. It's a key part of the heritage of the world that was, you know,
of Warhammer in general.
Of Warhammer, yeah. Like, the Skaven have been in it since year dot, really. And, you know, it's really nice that they're going to get this, like, they're finally going to get a bit of love and an updated model range, because, you know, they obviously had newish models, you know, towards the end, I guess towards the end of Warhammer Fantasy Battles, and then like a few, did they get any in Age of Sigmar 1?
They've had not in AOS 1, but they've had a couple over the years. So they've had Clan Pestilence.
Oh, yeah.
Underworld's Warband. I can't remember what their full name is.
And they got the ninjas as well, didn't they?
Yeah, there was the Eshin, was it Eshin or Scry? No, it would have been Eshin. Something or others. And then there was a new character as well when their Battletome came out in the form of the Deathmaster.
And also, let us not forget, and I say this because I sprayed a load of models today for AOS, funnily enough, that the can, the rattle can from which I sprayed them, is Grey Seer. And who are the Grey Seers but not the leadership of the Skaven?
Exactly.
Great Council. So clearly an integral part of the hobby, an integral part of Josh's contrast system as well.
Yeah, exactly. I owe them a lot.
Yeah.
There's a couple of things that I identify as being, and I've talked about this on live stream. I might have even talked about it on the podcast. There's a couple of things that if you ask me about Warhammer, it will conjure certain images in my head. And there's three that I would point to. And, that is so uniquely the way Games Workshop does them. Not that they're original concepts. I always have to caveat that before someone tells me they didn't come up with the idea. They actually ripped it off from this person.
I'm really,
Bert.
I'm really hoping there's somebody who's going to listen to this, and they've been, for the last like hour we've been recording, every time you've said something, they've been hovering over the War Hipster is a Games Workshop short, and then you've tempered it back by saying, well, you know, they didn't get this thing right. Like, yep. The trailer for AOS 4 is the best, but that's because 3 was rubbish, and they've gone, ah, oh, damn it, I can't say it.
You'd be surprised. It happens in my videos all the time. There's a couple of things, right? So, obviously, from 40K, iconic image is the Space Marine, obviously. And, it, you know, the classic Space Marine, the Mark
4.
7.
No,
Mark 7. Sorry. Yeah. With the grill at the front rather than the beak. That one, that helmet, always iconic image to me. The other one is Take a Trip to the Fantasy Battles is Skaven. And yes, rat men are not a uniquely Games Workshop thing, not by a long shot, but the way Games Workshop does rat men and the Skaven is very unique to them. It's very iconic to them. And they very much, they conjure up that kind of, this is Warhammer. Another one is the way they do lizard men as well. Like the whole concept of the way that they do them. And I was actually chatting to Joe the other night, and he said he always thinks of classic Chaos Warriors.
Do you want to tell people, sorry, for people who don't know, do you want to tell them who Joe is? Because we all know who he is.
But... Joe of Liam Dempsey's fame. Coles.
Joe Coles. The man, the legend, the national treasure.
Yeah. I was chatting to him the other night, and he said, you know, classic Chaos Warrior.
Yeah, big guy with a shield.
Big guy with a shield and horns on his helmet. Yeah, he was like, yeah, that to me is so iconically Warhammer, so, right?
So I was just this slight tangent, but we love a tangent on this podcast. But just before we started recording, we were actually showing off some like retro stuff that we had, because Rich, and we'll talk about Lord of the Rings later, but Rich has a couple of editions of strategy battle games strategy games in Middle Earth. The magazine, brilliantly, he has number 68 and number 69. Nice. And I actually have number 1 from when I collected it, so we were sort of comparing that. But I also, what I have over there on my little shelf of retro stuff, as well as a couple of few third edition codexes from 40K and other things, is the Games Workshop 2005 catalogue. And I flicked through that the other day, and to your point, Josh, like, the number of models that I saw in there, and it took me back to when I was a kid in 2005, flicking through that, going, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. Like, the old Demon Prince, the old Chaos Warriors for fantasy battles, like the old Chaos Space Marines, which I've got some that I terribly painted when I was a very young one.
Yeah, but like the old Chaos Warriors are also nostalgic because they were in one of the first White Dwarfs I read, for example.
Yeah, so iconic. And we should say as well, we are coming up for, and they've announced today, the 500th issue of White Dwarf.
Jamie, you got very excited by the Grom Brindle miniature, didn't you?
And you better believe I'm going to use that Legends data sheet in Casual Games, because that'll be fun.
Yeah, I'm desperate for that miniature. And I want it more than anything else I've ever seen in my entire life.
It's so, so wonderful. Yeah, it's just a thing of beauty, isn't it?
Yeah.
He does look very cool.
It's beautiful.
So look, that's AOS, and obviously touching on the 500th issue of White Dwarf, which I just think is pretty cool because we all grew up with it. We also have had, Josh, I'm sorry, we have also had some things happen in the world of Warhammer 40K. And those things really have been, we've obviously had the full release of the Tau Codex has come out. So, and I know we've got some crew that have gone, are on pre-order, I think, as of yesterday. The remaining ones are those. We've had the Orc Codex pop up, and we've had the Custodes Codex pop up, as well as a Munitorum Field Manual, an update to points for some of the factions. I think we won't go heavily into all of them, but the overall view seems to be, correctly, Orcs, really good, both as an army are really good, and also just the book is really good. It has loads of options, loads of variety. It's really orky. I will say big shout out to the big mech detachment. I can't remember quite what it's called, but it's the one where you can run loads of killer cans and loads of dreads, and the army rule is basically roll a d3, see what happens, and you get an ability, and it just makes you hazardous. I think that's super orky. It's really cool. Obviously has a lot of like actual power in it with I think the Bully Boys detachment is the one everyone's talking about, which powers up your big mechs, your big mega knobs and your knobs and your war bosses,
war boss units,
sorry
Warboss units.
Yeah, Warboss units, because obviously when character joins, gets the keyword. So again, to our point about characters joining and acting like a sergeant in some respects, just powers them up. So your boys, your Beast Snagger boys, loads of other stuff can get this. It's really powerful. I've seen some... do you know what I saw? I watched a couple of battle reports with people playing like the detachments and just having, like, I saw Tabletop Tactics have done one with the Cult of Speed. Which is really fun, just to see them playing the Cult of Speed with all the buggies and all of the like bikes and stuff like that. So yeah, loads in that. And then there was the Custodes Codex, and that came out and definitely didn't cause any problems whatsoever. Well, sorry, problems is the wrong word. Didn't cause any idiotic controversy whatsoever. So yeah, the book itself, I think, has been a little bit disappointing for Custodes players in that it's taken a lot of the power out of them. A lot of their key abilities have been taken away, things that they relied on. There are still things you can do with it. There's a great Hero Hammer detachment, which is called, I think, Auric Champions. Josh, am I right in saying
something like that?
You don't know, which it, like, it powers up the characters, so it's quite like, if you want to play Hero Hammer, it's a way to go. It makes your characters really good, but it doesn't really help the army overall. And I think the general opinion is it's been a bit of a blow for a lot of Custodes players.
That's not the biggest issue with it, though, is it? The biggest issue is that it's not been a biggest blow for Custodes players. It's that we have to once again refer people back to a post that Games Workshop made in 2020.
We will touch on it. Auramachian Toravalia Kesh, I think, is her name, which is, by the way, a really fucking cool name. I'm just going to put that out there. I think that's awesome. And there is actually, I've seen today on social media, there is at least one more in there, because they talk about, her, and she's on her jet bike, her Dawn Eagle jet bike, which is a different custodian. And this ignited possibly the dumbest piece of discourse in the history of this hobby that I have ever seen, which was people, I'll be blunt about it, people just being... just losing their minds over the fact that one of the characters in the book happened to be a woman. And it was just the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And I think to quote, or to misquote, but to say that the Bricky, who's a YouTuber who does videos about this one, he did quite a good video where he basically said, I'm kind of embarrassed to say that I'm a Warhammer fan at the moment, because the problem is that this went mainstream in the sense of nerd mainstream. It ended up in like various gaming websites and various other things, and also ended up in the Daily Mail, which is, you know, never a good thing to be in the Daily Mail, under the title It's Woke Hammer, which the article was, in inimitable Daily Mail style, terrible. My favorite parts of it, which I said on Twitter, were the fact that they used a picture of, they said it was sort of some of their stock photos, and they used one which said was titled An Enthusiast Enjoys a Game of Warhammer at a Games Workshop store, and it was the third edition, the Battle for McCrag 4th edition starter set from like 2005 or 2004.
Plumbed the archives for that one.
Yeah, plumbed the archives. And they also used some weird AI generated art of Henry Cavill in like medieval / vaguely sci-fi armor for some fucking reason. And unfortunately, this thing, and sorry, I am going to get quite sweary on this one, which I probably shouldn't, but I will. This just attracted like the fucking dregs of the internet. Like, people I'd never heard of were just, and sorry, not that I'm the metric for like if you're famous, obviously not, but like people who I had just had no idea existed, and frankly was all the better for it, were making videos and commenting on it, like game devs who I've never previously heard of, who have been involved in various controversies and things over the years, were making videos about like Games Workshop is woke. There was obviously a whole anti-Semitism element to it as well, related to like who owned shares in Games Workshop. The whole thing, bluntly, was utterly embarrassing. And the only thing that made me, that was a positive out of it, was that all the people I know in the hobby, you guys, people I respect, people I follow, all of them completely reacted against this and were like, yeah, this is bullshit. It's ridiculous. And frankly, kind of embarrassing and offensive. And I found that it was very easy to identify the good eggs from the bad eggs. And there were thankfully quite a lot of good eggs among the, you know, as a kind of self-satisfied way of saying, I feel like the community that I pay attention to and have curated is actually full of good people, because I didn't see anybody doing the whole, they made it a woman, this means I can't play my army anymore. Like, just fuck off then, bluntly. I have quite strong feelings about this, because I'm just like, come on.
Yeah, anyway, I'll say the reaction online seemed to be completely disproportionate for what is, you know, it's like, cool, they retcon some lore. They've done that a lot of the times previously. Look at Necrons. There's so many examples. Oh. My reaction to it, well, someone was like, hey, look, they've now got female custodians. It's like, oh, neat.
Yeah,
and then I moved
exactly
on with my day.
Exactly. And I will say, on your point there, sorry, I'm going to rant some more. Tell me to shut up if I go too far. But I will say, like, I thought someone made a great point, which is really in all that shit, right? It's the same thing. But these kind of lore originalists, they get really upset about this stuff, but they ignore completely either where things have changed, things have been retconned before, vis-a-vis, let's just give an example, the Votann. Hey, guess what, guys? Squats canonically aren't dead. They are alive, they're living in the center of the galaxy, and they're destroying planets, and there's whole empires of them. And the Imperium just, you know, didn't notice for 10,000 years, or however long it's been. They don't care about that, right? And again, to be clear, I'm not saying they should care, right? But they never get annoyed about that. They never get annoyed about the things that have been taken out altogether. We don't have, for example, Ilian Nastase, the half-human, half-Eldar, chief librarian astropath, to give him his proper title, of the Ultramarines. Who the fuck is Tigurius? No, it's Ilian Nastase. That's who it should be if you're a true, you know, lore purist for Games Workshop. But magically enough, you don't care about that, but you do care when it happens to be a woman. And that, for me, is the thing where I'm like, you know, there's no reason on this. And it was interesting to watch, because I think these people knew that they didn't really have much ground to stand on, because the argument very rapidly shifted from the problem was there is a female character, to, oh no, we don't mind there's a female character. What we mind is the way it's been shoved down our throat, the way we're being gaslighted. Because the Games Workshop social media account, I think just to basically shut these idiots up, just said, yeah, there have always been women in the 10,000. And that was it. And there is actually an interview, I think, with either Aaron Dembski Bowden or one of the bigger Black Library writers. Whoever wrote Master of Mankind, I think it was Dembski Bowden.
That was Dembski Bowden, yeah.
Yeah, where he actually did say, he said, yeah, it's an old interview. And for some reason, again, nobody had paid attention to it until this whole thing blew up. Which he actually said, you know, yeah, I originally pitched the idea of there being, like, I would have a female custodian in that book. And I was told at the time, maybe not, let's just carry on. But his point being, this is not a new idea. This is something that's been knocking around Games Workshop for years. And the only reason they didn't do it was because of model sales. They didn't think that, like, a female custodian, I guess, would sell, like, if they made a model, which has been the case for years. And, you know, clearly now we have loads of armies with good representation in them, or better representation. I wouldn't say good, but better representation than there has been, and they are selling really well. So maybe that's why they finally thought it's the time to do it. So, yeah, the whole thing, like, honestly, it's just been embarrassing. And I would really hope anybody who listens to this podcast, anybody who knows us, anybody who has ever interacted with us would know that, like, this is the kind of thing where we just think, be better, you know, be a better person. Like, you can, if you still want your custodies army to be all dudes for whatever reason, it's all dudes. If you want it to be all women, it can be all women. You can do what you want. You can do your hobby how you like, but don't start spewing really, really offensive, horrible shit just because Games Workshop has made a law change, which in the grand scheme of things is not consequential. The Custodian Guard have never been defined by being men. In fact, they've been very much defined by being not very human, full stop, right? I know they are fundamentally humans, and they are sort of, you know, they are produced through this methodology that we don't know the details of in the lore, with the Emperor sort of building them up from the atomic level. They're not actually created with, you know, gene seed or anything like Space Marines. So they are fundamentally different. It's never been a gendered thing. It's never depended on that. And it shouldn't going forward. And honestly, and I also think for all those people out there who have, like, done conversions where they've stuck, I've seen a lot with female Stormcast heads, actually, where people have put those on, right? Now you've got official backing, not that it ever mattered, right? So
no, it never mattered before.
That, yeah, that it never mattered before. I mean, but if it did, now it, you know, now you have it.
Also, like you said, it's like, oh, the only consequence of this is you might get more cooler models. Like, you'll get more cool models to hobby with.
Yeah, tell me you don't want a Talia Vedra or an Indrasta. equivalent for custodians, right? Like, why wouldn't?
I mean, I set my stall out about this on.
It's been done to death, guys. I know we're late to it. I just wanted to get my piece in.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's been embarrassing to be a Warhammerist during the last couple of weeks. Like the sad thing as well is that it was also predictable as well. You know, it's the idea that can be. I mean, the thing I said on the live stream is, if it really offends you, you need to learn why it really offends you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not make up a reason to justify why it really offends you, but actually just go and examine why that really offends you. And if it does really offend you and you do figure it out that, you know, you just have a problem with women in general, then you need to examine that. And if you're comfortable that way, then hey, guess what? You're a sexist. If not, then, you know, it's an opportunity for a lot of people to do a lot of personal growth. And I think, you know, just examine yourself at the end of the day. Like,
yeah,
what bothers you so much about a woman being in the 10,000 or multiple women being in the 10,000? Honestly, yeah. Like, the trouble is as well, and I will say that we are four white men.
Yep.
Talking about this from a position of privilege, and we're not the best people to, I mean, we're allies, really. We're not the best, we're not the standard bearers. And honestly, it's up to us to, you know, not to virtue signal or anything, but it is to set out the stall and just say, look, if you disagree, then go away. I don't want you to enjoy this podcast, really. Or consume the content. And it's like I said, we're not the right people to be sorting this out, and we have to recognize that as well. And be part of that and work towards, you know, balancing the equation more. We're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. This is, like I said, this is a podcast where it's privileged white men talking about war dollies, and you know that's what we are, and so it's important to recognize that as well, that we speak from a position of privilege to be able to say, oh, it's really dumb, and there'll be a bunch of people who will agree with us, and there'll be a bunch of people who disagree with us, but at the end of the day, our voices are not representative of the people who've really been wounded by this. And so it's important to just bear that in mind. And, you know, to any women out there who felt disappointed. Yeah. And be disappointed in us, you know, because it was an opportunity for the community to not once again show that it has its problems, and it failed. It's a massive failure. That Warhammer isn't as inclusive a space as it should be, and that is a failure, and it needs to be needs to be worked on.
And I would say, look, to people, I will try and be perhaps a bit nicer. If you are somebody who looked at this and was really like outraged, maybe not, you know, I think the people who were super outraged by it are almost like too far gone. I don't really know, you know, as I say, I think you need to go away and examine why you're outraged. But to other people who were like, oh, I don't really like this, and then, you know, have ended up in this, because I will say, I think there are a lot of people taking advantage of this, right? Again, slightly non-PC, quite sweary take on this was basically every dickhead on the internet jumped on this. Like, and this is what I mean about people I'd never heard of, like people who've been involved in, what is it, Gamergate and all that stuff that happened with video games, like started making videos and being like, pay me money and I will write petitions to Games Workshop, and started making videos on it. Like, I saw one example of somebody, I don't know the channel name, I'm not just avoiding it, I genuinely cannot remember, but I saw somebody repost it on Twitter, like mocking it, rightly, where somebody had made this video, and they get really annoyed about this whole thing about female custodians, but then they open it by going, you know, oh, I don't play. I've never really gotten into Warhammer. I don't really know what it's about. It's a game. It's a tabletop game made by GamesWorks, and I think it's been around a while. And you're like, dude, you know, I'm not going to get into the controversies of neurosurgery. Why are you suddenly making like content about something you clearly know nothing about? Like, what's the point? Just to outrage farm. And it was that real, and we have touched on it before in other contexts, that real horrible side of things like YouTube and, you know, social media generally, which is it's just outrage farming, and that's all it is. It's rage for clicks, and in some cases grifts for clicks, right? Because people are, you know, asking for money. You know, support my Patreon, I will stand up against the woke, you know, whatever. And it's like, just don't please, I beg you, even if you are a little bit irritated by this, you know, go away, examine why you're irritated, you know, try and work out what it is, but don't fall for those people. Don't make that the representatives of our community, because that's the thing, as I say, that made me sad beyond the actual content and some of the really vile stuff, which was vile beyond that content. It was the fact that, look, we are on the cusp, and we've talked about this before, Warhammer as a hobby, all of it, AOS, 40K, the lot. We're on like the edge. We're on the cusp of being mainstream, for want of a better term, right? There are more people playing the game in all its forms now than ever before. There are more people playing the video games. There are more people consuming the various books and the audiobooks and the lore and podcasts. It's still a niche hobby, but it's bigger than it's ever been, right? It just is. And we've got, you know, major celebrities like, you know, Henry Cavill, for example, and others who openly say, yeah, my favorite thing is Warhammer. I love playing Warhammer. And we've got this, you know, this TV series on the way. I don't want, and, you know, not that I want to hang everything on bloody Henry Cavill, but like, the last thing we should want as a community is to be known, you know, to tip over into the mainstream and everyone goes, Warhammer, what's that? Oh, isn't that the thing they were all getting mad about with women? Do you know what I mean? Like, do we really want that to be what our community is known for, rather than being, hey, it's a bunch of games that you can go and play with your friends and it's fun? That's the thing it should be known for, right? And it's this really cool in-depth universe which has all these different bits to it that you can learn about. That's what it should be known for, not just fucking outrage because there happens to be a woman in the room. Like, it's just sad. It's saddening and it's alienating. We've said it before. Why don't you want more people to play with, right? If having a you know, leaving aside that there shouldn't even need to be a reason for it, but if nothing else, if making something like the Custodians just a little bit more representative, right, means that somewhere somebody, you know, a girl or otherwise, says, hey, I really like that. I'm gonna collect them. I'm gonna play them. It means you've got more people to play with. Why wouldn't you want that? More people to roll dice with. So that's my appeal, man. Let's be better. Let's be better as a community. And let's you know, there'll be something else. There will be outrage about other things, but
yeah. Oh, you know. Well, I was going to say to tangent away from this. if you want to be mad at something, be mad at me rolling sixes, which is what Adam was on the weekend.
Yeah. Okay. So we will move rapidly on from that debacle. And I will say, Orc players, enjoy your codex. Custodes players, you know, look for the spice in there. Keep going. And everybody else, enjoy the MFM. They changed some points. I think Space Marines did quite well out of it. I think others didn't. Crack on. That's all I got to say.
Demons got no changes.
Demons did get no changes. That was fun. Everyone, Josh has died. He's done. He's given up.
No changes. They're fine. Perfect. Perfectly balanced.
As all things. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. The MFM. But I think, Jamie, you're happy, right? The MFM gave Space Marines a bit of a kick up the bum.
It didn't really.
No. Oh, okay. I just saw. Is only because I tangentially saw that some points had changed some things and people seemed reasonably excited about it. Or
it's a bit of an internal balance thing for Marines. In fact, if anything,
it seemed to be just giving you more options to play with and toning some of down the more egregious things.
Yeah, my Oxford list, for instance, went up by 20 points, but that was a fairly well tuned list. It had Death Company and the Martis, which both went up. So actually, Blood Angels. Pretty much all of the unique units went up, apart from the Death Company Dread, which is a really fun but underused unit, and it's that. So that's where it is with Marines, which is a really good place, I think, to be. Actually, it's an indicator. Marines was the first codex. where we are with that now is tweaking points for internal balance, because actually external balance is really good now.
Tyranids, a similar position where Gargoyles went up and then everything, a couple other things that weren't really being used that much went down. So like my list, which is, I'd say like strong, but not like the most like tournament competitive, that went like down 20 points. So it means I can get an enhancement where I didn't have one before, but it also meant that like, oh, if I drop this monster, I can now fill that position with two or three units I couldn't before.
I mean, I think the only thing that's really caught a proper nerf was Necrons, which was needed on a couple of units.
Catan
primarily. That was that they've gone up. Monolith's gone up, which I don't actually think Disney, but nonetheless,
really?
The Technomancers are the.
Why has the monolith gone up? Just because one person won something or double six?
I did take it on at Oxford. I mean, I've played it a couple of times. If you play Oxford, he's a very, very good unit. However, T-13, it's just getting rid of the bastard thing as well. Yeah. T-13, 4-up Invuln, huge guns, and then also is giving the ability that it's got. It is really good. It's just it shouldn't necessarily be the problem, I don't think. But Catan went up was a really good thing. We desperately needed that. And the Technomancers going up, which attach to Wraiths and make them incredibly unkillable.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that was the right round, but we'll see what happens.
Well, so it's interesting you say that, Jamie, because I did one. The one bit I did watch was I saw the Meta Watch video they did where they interviewed, I think his name's Josh, the chap from, I guess, the
Josh Roberts movie. Is doing it now, yeah.
Yeah, who I will say comes across really
he's
well.
He's won like four GTs, I think, this year with Necrons as well. So yeah. Benefited really well out of it before then. Just got all of his UKTC scores in, got his ranking, and then went, it's fine, fuck them, yeah. I'll move on to the next one.
Enough of them now. I thought he came across really well, actually. And one of the things he said on that video, to your point about Technomancers, was he said, well, we tried to look at it, and we were just like, if the Wraiths on their own are powerful, and in a few detachments they're good, but we don't think they're the problem. The problem is we think when you attach the Technomancer, that's what makes them like really, really good in hybrid.
No, he's running three of them.
So he's got the inside line, right? And he said, "Oh yes," and we put the points up on that. So I don't know. It came across well. I think it seemed to me a sign that things might be. The interview at least seemed to me a positive that things might be going the right way with some of the rules writing, but not for demons though, because they just hate Josh.
No changes, they're fine, perfectly balanced. All things should be.
Don't need any changes.
Are they in early codex? Actually, I can't remember whether
they haven't had a codex yet.
No,
they're not on the.
They're going to get the last one of the edition and be the most powerful thing you've ever seen, and then immediately go to 11th.
To be honest, I think they can't do that to us twice. If anything, the problem that demons have is probably actually the allies, isn't it? That's the difficult bit.
What, being able to ally in some Space Marines?
No, being able to, the other way around, ally into CSM.
Oh, right, yeah.
So that's the only, that was the bit of play they'd have for a while. I mean, they've still got it now. Great and Clean One, for instance, can go into CSM, etc. Might be that that's not been as good an idea as it was, even if introducing the battle line. So you now have to have a battle line along with any other
demon
you have. If you're allying them in. And that was seen as being the control mechanism.
Stop the blue scribe.
It has been a control mechanism. It means that you don't see very many of them seeped in. But that's probably the one blocker I can see with them. And it's probably not dissimilar with knights as well. So, you know, Brigands caught a points rise a little while back. Yeah. And that wasn't about them for Chaos Knights.
It was for them in CSM.
For CSM. That's one of the more problematic allied rules that they have out there, because it's impacting two codexes that aren't actually the target of any time that the points have gone up, as far as I can see.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
I want to write the Chaos Demons Codex.
No.
So here's the thing is, so we've said outside of the podcast, we've talked previously about, it's like, oh, if you give a codex to someone who loves the faction, they will inevitably write a really fun codex, but it will also be probably far too powerful.
But this was this was the point you made, Josh, when we were talking the other night. And it's worth repeating here because I thought it was bang on about the difference between like some of the AOS books and some of the 40K books. And it goes to your point earlier about saying 40K has been around for so long that people love a faction. They might like 40K, but they love a faction. They don't love the game. Well, it sounds weird to say, but they don't love the overall game. They're focused on their faction, right? So the problem is with the AOS, or not, sorry, the good thing is the AOS team maybe aren't quite that way. They just love AOS, so everything is quite good and interactive and fun. Whereas exactly with 40K, what seems to be happening is they give them, they're like, hey man, you really love Eldar, write the Eldar Codex or the Eldar Index. Whereas they're like, what do you like, Steve? Oh, I don't know, orcs. Cool, you're going to write the Admech Codex. And he's like, oh, okay, well, Admech, better not make them too powerful. And then you get two come out at the same time, and it's just like, oh.
Well, I mean, look at the codexes you've had so far. Like, Tau clearly are no longer being punished for their 7th edition antics.
Which is good.
Which is good. But that codex is bonkers. That was clearly written by a fan. Orcs, the Orcs Codex was clearly written by a fan.
It was definitely written by someone who at the very least appreciates orkiness.
No, it's written by someone who was a fan. Like, come on. Like, it's probably the best codex that's been written so far in terms of sheer bloody-minded variety. And also just consistent power throughout that variety.
Yeah,
if you look at the other codexes we've had so far, like, there'll be one where you'll go, oh yeah, that's really good. And then you'll go, oh, there's another one. Yeah, that's pretty good. And then the rest, it's like, why bother? So like the Orcs one, it's like, yep. Oh, that one's a bit, but you know, it is what it is. There's always going to be one or two in a book that aren't necessarily as powerful. Or they're a bit more of a thinking man's way of playing the game, as it were.
The thinking Orcs way of playing the game.
The thinking Orcs way of playing the game. Yeah. It's like, do you remember when the 8th edition Space Marine supplements came out?
Yeah.
And there were some that were clearly written by fans of said faction.
Yeah.
Specifically the one person in the office who was a massive fan of Iron Hands was just like, Joe, I'm just going to write the best fucking codex anyone's ever seen.
And Unkillable Dreadnought sounds fine to me.
Exactly. But then you also had ones like, so like, I remember when the Raven Guard one came out at the same time, right?
Yeah.
And everyone said the Raven Guard one was rubbish. But then when Iron Hands caught its first, not really a nerf, but caught its first...
Took three.
Its first nerf. Everyone went, Iron Hands are dead. What should we play next? And a bunch of people went, Raven Guard, you can teleport those Centurions 9 inches away. It's like, oh, cool. So I can just take the exact army I'm playing now, play it as Raven Guard, because it was a bit more of a thinking man's codex, as it were. But it's, you know, it is what it is. The Orcs one has clearly been written by a fan. The Admech one has been written by somebody who was abused in 9th edition.
It was me.
Yeah, it was written by you after you were abused by it at the LGT.
Yeah.
The Admech one, it's like, who hurt you? to the author. Like, can you demonstrate on the miniature where you got beaten round the head?
Well, it's like the Custodes one, right? You just sit there and you're like, clearly somebody got whoever wrote this just got like, you know, kicked in the bum repeatedly at a tournament by Custodes with their like four up. Probably had a load of mortal wounds and was like, yeah, I'm gonna do mortal wounds. They were like, nah, man, four up. And they were like, right, I'm fucking taking that away. Get out of the room, you.
Yeah. The story we were talking about, as I was talking about 8th edition Imperial Knights. The 8th edition Imperial Knights Codex was written by somebody who absolutely fucking loves Imperial Knights.
Yeah.
It's clear, you read that book, I was going to go and get it and I was going to do Man Reads book for this episode, but I ended up not doing it. You read that book and you go, this is written by somebody who adores Knights, because it's an absolutely bonkers book. It is insane. And it's like, what? How is this as good as it is? Like, there's no way it should be this good. And that's not been written by somebody who has balance in mind. That's been written by somebody who's like, I love this faction, how can we make it play exactly like it should, and how can we make it the best possible book it's ever been written? And that is what they did. And then, of course, it caught the nerf. But it happens all the time in 40K. Constantly, consistently. Every single edition always happens.
Yeah.
And you get punished for the sins of the previous edition, which is not, it's not, I don't think that's fair on fans. I remember I've got a friend of mine who lives in Leeds, who is one of the six people who is genuinely a fan of Iron Hands.
Was pre-codex or pre-supplement.
Has somewhere in the region of 12,000 to 15,000 points of Iron Hands. Like, adores them. For some reason. Don't know why, but just adores them. Just absolutely loves them. And then that supplement came out. And I had a conversation with him and he said, I hate it. And I was like, why? He's like, because of this, Iron Hands will be punished for the next decade. Turned out that in 10th edition, it didn't matter if you had an Iron Hands army.
Eldar seem to get away with it every edition as well.
Well, yeah, but I think Eldar are going to get it. At some point in the future, Eldar are going to get someone's going to write the Eldar.
They're dodging it. They're Farseers. They're Farseers are seeing the future because every edition, I'm sure there's one in the mists of the past where Eldar were genuinely crap. But Eldar always are consistently up there. They're normally just obscured by whatever is slightly more bonkers for whatever period.
At some part of the edition, there's been some indexes that were not that great, but as soon as you get a codex, they've been great.
But to be fair, again, part of that comes from you know, a combination of where they sit on what I would call the 40k baseline. You know, so if you're saying the baseline is like 3+ ballistic skill, 4+ toughness, you know, like Space Marine profile, right? They sit kind of, you know, in a weird mix of the two where they've always been like, you know, pretty good 3+ ballistic skill. Yeah, toughness 3 because they're Eldar, but then they get like tricks to make up for that. So they have like a good combination of just their baseline is pretty good, which means that it's quite hard for them to kind of be pushed down, because then what goes on top of that is they have a huge, because they're such an old model range, they've got such a deep codex of a variety of things they can draw on.
I do think there are, like, as an army concept, they are very specialized, often do damage, but are very fragile. There's usually ways to play them that they can do well. If you take something like Death Guard, it's their sort of unique thing is they're tough. And while Eldar can play into any sort of meta, Death Guard kind of, sometimes if you're not careful with and how you build your army, they can just be that stat check of, am I tough enough to survive? Yes, no.
Isn't good anyway. Bad Eldar isn't good Eldar. Good Eldar that have very lethal data sheets, that have a few tricks, that are that can have really vast output, is good. I like that. That's what Eldar are. Bad Eldar are where Eldar are really easy to play, or where Eldar are point and click, at least in recent times. And that's where, say, for example, you know, the initial index and, you know, two subsequent data slates later went massively wrong with Eldar and 40k in this edition.
Conceptually, they should be low skill army. They should be like low skill floor, high skill ceiling.
Eldar should be, I think Eldar should actually be quite a high floor as well, to be completely honest. As high as you're willing to go within a game that you want people to be able to pick up.
I disagree, because I think if you play Eldar wrong, they're supposed to be a fragile army. So if you play them wrong, then you get punished for them. So you should know how to get the most out of your army to then, like, not so like super, super low ceiling that only best players can play them. Like, you should still be able to win your games and enjoy them. But you need that sort of like extra echelon to then compete at the top levels and get the most out of them. And you should be able to do that. But it should be hard and skillful to do that.
But where, I think that covers it anyway. They're essentially that, because they are fragile, because if you misplay them, that is, to me, essentially makes them a higher floor.
They've got a
super low floor, you know, Death Guard and Custodes, because they will withstand so much and you can make mistakes with them potentially. Well, say that, Death Guard, different actually. That's more about movement. You make movement mistakes.
Yeah. One day, Games Workshop will make a 40k edition that is dominated by close combat again. And when that day comes, Eldar will be terrible.
It's doing pretty well at the moment again, though.
No, but what I mean is, like, I'm talking about, you know, back in the days sweeping advance with Khorne Berserkers. You know, it only took 10 models and you could clear your entire opponent's army. I'm talking that levels of combat. That's what needs to happen. Like, and then all those toughness 3 Eldar and toughness 3 Tau, they will all get in the bin. I tell you what you do. You make every single gun in the game AP 0, damage 1.
Every single one of them. It's like, I'm going to roll my dice, then you roll your saves, and that's it.
Yeah.
Every single gun, AP 0, damage 1, strength 2. And then we make all of the combat weapons actually feel like combat weapons. That would be
AP,
great.
AP 3, strength 9.
Yeah, yeah. Damage 10.
Anti-vehicle plus, 4 plus, anti... Yeah, no. No, well, what I'd say, and this is obviously not... We're focusing a lot on Eldar here, but I would say one of the things that was interesting about the Eldar Index when it came out, and we've said this before on the podcast, is that what they then did, on top of all the data sheets and everything else, is they went, hey, guys, so we've got a game in which we're trying to do less rerolls. Okay, well, let's make them their army rule, an army ride, like, reroll ones rule, which helps, or reroll a dice. And then also, on top of that, in a game that's entirely based, in theory, on, you know, dice rolls... and on, you know, the randomness of dice rolls potentially failing or succeeding, let's give them an ability to just flatten the curve whenever they want to, right? And obviously they've now pared that back, but I think that's why it's been interesting in 10th edition. But look, we talked too much about 40k. We spent like an hour on Age of Sigmar, and we've now spent like an hour on 40k. Anybody say this was a 40k podcast, which, you know, it might normally be, but I actually do need to change that because we are just the Conclave now. We have been playing, and Rich, you alluded to this earlier, talking about dice rolls, talking about flattening the curve. God, I sound like this is like flashbacks to, sorry, if I'm giving anybody flashbacks to 2020 with the term flattening the curves. I know it was used a lot in COVID. I apologise. But Mr. Gwotkin and myself, and Mr. Jamie, actually, will be, once he gets them painted up, will be participating, are currently enjoying a Middle Earth strategy battle game campaign. And Mr. Gwotkin is playing as the dwarves. You're not Erebor Reclaimed, you're Khazad-dûm, is that right?
Yeah, so I'm Khazad-dûm. Because we're doing a map campaign, my specific dwarves are from the Blue Mountains. I've been marching across the whole map, and I've reached Moria, and on the weekend we had the battle for Moria.
Yes, and it was very cool. But I've taken away some learnings from this game. I think we all did, which is having now fought Rich, what, 4 times? I think I've played you. Yeah. One is just a learning game. One of the, which is, one, the problem is when Rich's dwarves are really tough, as they, to be clear, should be, and need to be wounded on 5s and 6s by pretty much anything, that's quite hard. But when Rich just needs like to roll 6s to kill you or to do anything else or to save himself, he can do it. He can do it on command. This man is the spider of our campaign. He is Lawrence Baker reincarnated.
I will say my 6s were not obnoxious as they were a couple of weeks ago.
No,
they were really obnoxious back then.
A couple of weeks ago,
I rolled like a decent amount of 6s on the weekend.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago when we played the game, myself and big shout out to Hill and Hammer on Instagram, Alex, our friend who's playing as Mordo, we did a joint game against Richard's Dwarves, and about 2/3 of the way through, I just looked at Alex and what I said on Sunday was like, what can men do against such reckless dice rolls? Because it's just like, you just nothing. Just dying all over the shop. but it is very fun.
Yeah, there was one moment, we were also playing against Ollie as well on the weekend, this was in the second game, and, you know, some Warg Riders, some cavalry that he's got, which are usually charging and very good. I had a fight against a couple of Mori Goblins, and I managed to win that one, and it's like, cool, so there's 2 of them, I need to like wound the orcs, and then there's courage tests for the wargs if they get, you know, wounded to see if the wargs stay, and I needed 5s and 6s to wound them. I got a 5 and a 6 on 2 dice. Both the orcs died, both the wargs ran away, and 2 goblins, you know, 10 points just took out 24 points of models.
It was just the fact you were like, right, I'm going to get them, and you just went, you know, win the combat. What happened? You were like, right, go for the orc, kill the orcs, go for the warg, kill the warg, wargs are dead, everything's dead. And Ollie was just like, what do I do? To be fair, there was a moment like that. there was a moment like that in the Moria game as well, where there were a whole series of combat. Because if people don't know with Middle-earth, and I would strongly, strongly encourage people who are Warhammer players of any kind to go check out the Middle-earth strategy battle game, because it is really, really good. It's real good fun. And it is very much, more so than any of the other systems, I think, just dependent on dice rolls, which I know sounds weird, but there are ways of kind of flattening out, but it's really hard to do that in a lot of cases.
There is that element of luck that definitely plays into it, but it's more so than any of the other games. I would say it's about movement and positioning.
Yeah.
Because if you can get, so in 40K, there's that sort of like try point of like not get length, someone run away. If you put three models around them, then, you know, it costs them stuff to fall back. In Lord of the Rings, that means if you win the fight, you then get twice the amount of attacks against that model. So it's
because they're trapped.
It can really make it swing hard. So if you've got more models and you trap stuff on the flanks, then you kind of just get a rolling effect where you move in, trapping more and more models until you surround the enemy.
Yeah.
So positioning is really key.
So we had a bunch of combats where Rich was rolling for them. And basically, bear in mind, we were doing effectively a 3-on-1 game, because Rich was the dwarves and I was Isengard.
Same points per side, but...
Yeah, same points per side in total. But
three players versus one player.
Just for the thematics of the dwarves trying to take back the Moria from this sort of alliance of evil made up of kind of Angmar, Mordor, and Isengard. None of us took the goblins in that one. I don't know why. Maybe we should have done. I offered them to you. But it was quite funny, because there was one combat moment where you basically were just... You were rolling for all the combat. You were just like, yeah, he's dead. Yeah, he's dead. Yeah, he's dead. And I just turned around to someone, Ollie, on my team, and I was like, should we just go get a cup of coffee while he finishes out the round? Because we're not doing it.
Yeah, it was that case of if you both, for those who don't know, in Middle-earth, you don't just try to attack and hit and wound each other. When you meet in combat, you both roll dice, and whoever has the highest dice wins combat and gets the chance to wound. And if you tie the dice roll, then the person with the higher fight value wins. And against two of the three armies, not against your Uruks, but against the other two, the dwarves have the higher fight value, which means that if I roll a 6, it doesn't matter what the orcs roll. I'll win the fight and get to roll to wound. So what was happening, it was a string of a number of fights in a row where I just rolled that 6. So I was like, cool, I roll a 6, now I wound. Cool, I roll a 6, now I wound. Cool, I roll a 6, now I wound.
Yeah, it was very, and it's funny, because Middle Earth is much more of a I go you go type game in terms of every bit of every phase, rather than
it's one turn, and you share the shooting, you share the movement, you share that
exactly,
and there are priority rules.
Rather than being, you know, I move, I shoot, I charge, I fight.
Yeah,
you know, so it was quite funny. But we should say, look, apart from boring people with talking about our particular games, although again, really good fun, really would recommend. And also, if you're an Isengard player, and you know, every Isengard player's out there's going to be like, yeah, mate, duh.
Funnily enough, shooting twice as much on hitting better and making everyone around you shoot better as well is actually quite good.
Yeah, it's really good that. Yeah. Anyway,
I told you, Adam. To build your army of the dead.
I built my army. This is what I was about to say. We're boring people just about our games. And I know what you're going to say, Josh, and you can say it in a second. We have had some stuff come out and some stuff be announced for Lord of the Rings. And in the Middle-earth strategy battle game, Lord of the Rings, that's been relatively rare. One of the gripes from some people in the community has been, oh, we haven't heard anything from Games Workshop. What's going on? Some of the more catastrophizing stuff has been, oh, the game's dead, you know, this, that, and the other. Clearly not. So we've had these were announced a while back, but I'm going to talk about them because they've just arrived and I built them this afternoon. The Army of the Dead in clear plastic came out, special edition ones, and they look amazing.
Should have used them yesterday. You could have bullied Rich up and down that battlefield with his goblins. What is it? On your goblins? There, yeah, go on.
They weren't built yesterday, and that would have been wildly unfair. I'll stick to my Isengard for that. But I'll bring. Do you know what I'll do? Now I've built them, because I would like to use them. I will bring them if we do a special scenario in which the Army of the Dead can be involved. I will bring them out, and we can see what.
Oh yeah, there'll definitely be a chance to bring them out for sure.
But they are I will just say they are really cool. They look amazing. I was a bit worried about the brittleness of the plastic, the clear plastic. I know that's an issue in some of the clear plastic sculpts, but it wasn't really an issue on these.
It did come with a special warning for that as well.
They did. So they actually do have a little leaflet in the packet, which. I mean, you know, audible mediums, people can't see, but they actually have a little leaflet that says, that I'll hold up for my colleagues on the camera, that basically says, don't cut them at the point, you know, where you would normally cut a sprue at the join with the part. Don't do it there. It might be better in some cases to cut further back. So cut the little sprue flash and then cut that off separately. I did that in a few occasions on some of the weapons because they're a bit fiddly. But yeah, all together, went together really well, really nice. Yes. And they're sitting on my shelf looking awesome. And I do have the three hunters, Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas. And there is a Legendary Legion, which is them plus the Army of the Dead. So it's the thematic, you know, Battle of Pelennor Fields ending, effectively, when they all come off the boat. So I'm planning to get everything painted up and the army sort of dry brushed a bit, the Army of the Dead guys. Just to kind of be able to field that, because I think it'd be quite fun. And again, we'll have some scenarios in the campaign where hopefully that will be relevant. But yeah, we've also had the announcement of Arnor stuff, right, Rich?
Yeah, which is some proper new models for the first time in ages, and it's also for an army that the current models don't seem to be online anymore. So there's more speculation of maybe they'll be redoing those. We don't know yet, but very exciting stuff. There are two supplements on the way. This one almost confirms that there's something to do with Arnor and maybe even Angmar. There's lots of speculation about what the second one might be as well. But everyone is very excited because Middle-earth is finally getting a little bit more love, a couple more new models. It's just a good time.
Yeah, I would encourage people to check out Lord of the Rings Gondor Terrain, because you got some, didn't you? And you thought it was really, really good. At least that was my recollection.
Yeah. It's the best terrain. It's the way that has a little bit been replaced for me, just in terms of how it looks, by the absolute wonderful, which I'll hold up for the gentleman on the camera now, the idol of the old ones.
Oh, the idly old ones, the frog face is awesome.
Yeah, this is one of the most beautiful pieces of terrain they've ever made. However, the way the Gondor scenery works is unbelievable. Like, so you have the two main aspects of it, the manor, which is the intact building, and you have the ruins as well. Both of those kits are cross compatible. So you can build a ruined manor, you can build a manored ruin, you can combine the ruins together to make mega ruins, you can build tiny little ruins, you can build two manors together to make an enormous manor, you can do all this kind of thing. The only thing that doesn't actually fit with them is the tower, because the tower is just completely different. It's not actually that modular, but the tower is enormous. Is
that being said,
gigantic.
You can make square towers if you want to, and I've seen someone do that, and then they had a ruined top and put, I think, like a Rohan bell in there, so it was like basically a bell tower.
Yeah, so you can do that. But the Gondor Tower, you can wear it like a Pringles tube on your arm, is genuinely enormous. I think it's about 12 inches tall. It's a huge bit of terrain, which is just really cool. And of course, it does have the option to have a intact roof or a ruined roof, which is cool, but there is something very cool about those. The white ruins of Osgiliath are very iconic from the films, so I mean, I have such a special attachment to it. I've talked about it before, but my younger brother and I used to play the ambush at Osgiliath as a scenario that we made up ourselves constantly with my entire Lord of the Rings collection. That was a thing we used to do a lot of, and I would have killed to have the Osgiliath terrain at that age, but obviously that wasn't meant to be yet. But it's just a beautiful set, and like the bundle that they've previewed is three, depending on price, this is either going to be one of the most ridiculous savings I've ever seen from Games Workshop, or it's going to be an obnoxiously priced box of terrain. But it's three manors, which all come at a £50 each. And then there's, on the picture, they've gone for seven ruins, but they say there's six ruined sections, which either means, I can't remember if the box comes with two sprues or one sprue. I think
so. The box comes with enough to build two buildings, but in the starter box, they put two of that in, so you can build four buildings from the starter box. But the yes. actual separate box, which I think is about 30 quid, you can build two ruins.
Yeah, so the question I have is it six lots of that?
I believe it's three build lots like of five, that? Six buildings, which means it'll seven be out of 90 it quid's worth.
Yeah, it says here, yeah, you get a Gondor tower, three Gondor mansions, and six sections of Gondor ruins.
Yeah. So either
just going by the pictures, that would be three boxes, each building two ruins.
But they've got seven ruins in the picture, Rich.
That's what I did see it was an odd number, and I was like, this is weird.
But yeah, so it's either...
And then the tower
if that box is £150, like so many of those large terrain sets are, it's literally 50% off that amount of terrain. Yeah. And
anything under 200 quid is great value.
Yeah, and I've got one mana, one tower, and five ruins, because I built the ones you could out of Osgiliath, the box, and Games Workshop very kindly sent all of that to me. And then when the individual pack of ruins came, I went, I'm going to make a mega ruin. So I made one enormous big one. And that's the thing about it, is of all of those six sections of ruins in that, you could just build one massive ruin.
I was going to say, go to Zorpazorp on YouTube if you want to see the extent that you can use this, because he built all of Osgiliath, basically, or close enough to. But it is a mega board. And then he builds half of Minas Tirith as well. This kit is insane for its modularity and how big and tall you can go with it.
Yeah, it's great. It's genuinely one of the best things they've ever made.
That is very cool. It looks awesome. And, you know, as somebody who now has a table upon which we play Lord of the Rings more than anything else at the moment, actually, it is something that I was like, oh, that'd be cool to go with my village.
And you don't actually need that much terrain for a Lord of the Rings game.
No. So it's for the theme. I just thought it'd be cool because then we can actually fight in a city, right? Rather than village.
This is the thing, Adam. There is a universe where if you buy a box and I buy a box and Rich buys a box, that means we have
Osgiliath.
Yeah, we could make.
I'm already got the starter set terrain as well. So
as do I. Between the stuff I've already done, and
if you've got a half dozen, I've got like some of them. It's like 10 or so, and then there's 10, 11 bits of terrain per box. That could be 40 ruins between us.
Yeah, so we could make a gaming table that has more scenery than models on it.
I think at that point you'd probably need with 40 ruins, you'd probably need at least two, like you'd need at least like a 12 by 4 table to get all that on.
Nope, I want to do it on a 4 by 4.
Densest table possible.
Yeah.
So exactly. What you're saying is like, I'll build all my terrain modular so we can stack it like three levels high.
Yes.
So basically we'll be fighting through like, you know when Minas Tirith, when the after, because it's, you know, a bit ruined, right? It's after the bombardment by the catapults, Grond has breached the gate and now we are flooding into Minas Tirith and we're just playing one section of like the very vertical like houses of the wall.
Yeah. How else are we going to make use of the excellent push back, fall down and falling models rules that are present in Middle-earth strategy battle games?
I will say we did make
rules
some
that we
use
need
of them.
To actually read properly, because that's come up in like two or three games and we've never we've just been like, I think it's this, let's use this.
Yeah, we had
haven't
scenarios
actually looked up
where
the rules properly.
We had scenarios where orcs were climbing up ruins to get to dwarves and then inevitably getting battered off them. It wasn't going well for them.
Isn't it you take a strength
we did the strength hit. Three hit per hider model, but we didn't look up the pushback and falling off. But
yeah, we made looked up the climb rules, didn't we? Yeah. To see how
we looked up the climb rules, but we need to actually go back and double check when you actually get pushed off.
Yeah, yeah, basically my message would just be Lord of the Rings is really fun and you should play
it. It's the most narrative game of all the ones of all the main systems that Games Workshop produce. I'm sure Necromunda is also very narrative as well. But of some of the more main systems, it's been the most narratively coherent that I've played, at least.
Yeah. Cool. Look at that. We're just over 2 hours, and we covered, you know, three whole game systems. It's been pretty good, I think. Pretty good.
Jamie, do you want to talk about Baldur's Gate 3?
I think that's got to be one for another time, but I mean,
we could do a special podcast just about that.
I'm on a third playthrough, and I've just found a whole other underworld bit that I didn't know existed, an entire society.
Right, in the Underdark?
That I didn't know. Yeah, but the Underdark particularly. I didn't really talk about the Underdark. Or
I was going to say, have you got to your third playthrough and not known the Underdark exists?
No, I'd been in there, but I'd sort of gone in and gone, oh, this is all a bit boring. I'm going back out. And now that I've actually found the people. And then I've got off to where all the slave traders are. And I'm just, especially because I'm on a dark urge, I'm just killing all the slave traders. That's the next job.
The soundtrack to Baldur's Gate 3 lives rent-free in my head.
I mean, will it just won a BAFTA as well? It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's one of the best games ever made.
Yes, I agree. 100% one of the best games. I was just going to say that the moment in House of Hope, if you've been there, you'll know it.
Yes.
But that moment is one of the best moments in gaming I've ever experienced.
I've not properly played this thing yet.
I'm saying no spoilers.
Okay. I'm not even into
D&D either. Like, that's how good a game it is. I've resisted D&D for years and years and years. It's not for me whatsoever. And then I've like leapt into this and just gone, oh my god, everything about this is incredible.
I'm well into D&D. I am doing Curse of Strahd at the moment in real D&D, and that's been we've already had about three near total party kills, because that's been fun. We are not equipped for Barovia, I'll tell you that. But we got put it this way, all I'll say is a brief anecdote. In the last game, we went to look for something, and it turned out to be surrounded by some crates. Those crates each contained vampire spawns. There were 7 of them. We are not a particularly high AC party. We're not a particularly punchy party, just because of the various classes we have taken. And there was a moment when a fireball, right, one of them had woken up and was causing us enough problems, and a fireball woke up the other 6. Luckily, one of our party had turn undead. It happened that 6 of the 7 failed it. Or sorry, it worked on 6 of the 7. So they just stayed out of the battle. Because if they'd have gone in, we would have been dead.
Yeah.
So we got very lucky.
Baldur's Gate 3 changed something about the way I view the world.
This is concerning.
No, so Baldur's Gate 3, right, is a product that was made by people who really, really, really fucking love Dungeons & Dragons. They really love it. And they poured their hearts and souls into it. And they released a game that was ready. It wasn't broken. It was great. It's full of content. And they continue to support it and make changes and updates as the community asks for them and points them out. So I played it. Now, the first time I stepped away from it, I went, I wish every single hobby that I had applied the same amount of detail, care, love, and just, you know, passion into all of the things that they make, especially in video games. But just afterwards, I was like, Baldur's Gate 3, man, you've changed the game. It's changed the game for me in terms of, like, just everything, really. I ought to change my Land Raider scale to the Baldur's Gate 3 scale. Like, I adore that game. Yeah, it's best one of the best games ever made.
It is rather marvelous. How many playthroughs are you on now?
I have done 4 playthroughs. I had to stop because I have a YouTube channel that sucks most of my time out of me. Because when the game came out, right, I was like, I've got enough videos. I'm good. I've got enough videos for a couple of weeks. And then it got to the end of that couple of weeks, and I was like, I've done nothing. I need to seriously pull my finger up.
That was a problem for Future Josh, and then you became Future Josh.
Yeah. I just, you know, it made me laugh. It made me cry. It makes me feel things. It's just a beautiful game. It's a beautiful, beautiful game. that is an absolute triumph of nerdery.
Gamage.
Yeah.
Well,
I know it's not for everyone, but, you know, it's...
Well, you know, look, in the immortal words of a certain somebody, because we should probably round it out there, to say, on that bombshell, I think it is time to end. Very nice bombshell to go out on as well, although, again, I need to actually... I've got it downloaded. I just don't... I'm in the same boat. Not that I have a YouTube channel, more that I just have lots of other things and I haven't had time to play it, but I will. So, on that note, on our little jaunt through the Mortal Realms, and indeed through Faerun, as we have touched on Baldur's Gate, I think it is time for us to say goodbye. We will be back, certainly next month, which is like in about 2 days, so it's not really saying much, but we'll be back. And I'm sure there'll be other things for us to talk about. And, you know, by that point, but actually by the time we do our next episode, it will very likely be after we have been, myself and Mr. Warhipster, as well as some of our other friends who are not on the show tonight, have been to Warhammer World to the weekend they're doing for AOS, which we were lucky enough to get tickets to. So we will have actually played a little bit of the game. So we'll be able to wax lyrical even more about what the new edition is like. And, you know, I think Jamie and Rich, if you have questions, it'd be good to get them, which will be fun. So all I would say is, look, have fun, enjoy yourselves, enjoy your hobbies, do your 40k, do your AOS, do your Lord of the Rings, and do your Baldur's Gate if you haven't already. And it is goodbye from me, Mr. ADR Wargaming. Goodbye. It is goodbye from Mr. Josh the War Hipster.
Oh yeah, bye.
He was distracted. He was distracted by Baldur's Gate.
I thought you were saying goodbye for me. I was
prompting you. It's meant to be it's like a talk and response thing.
I thought you were about to say it's goodbye from me, goodbye from Josh, goodbye from Jamie, and goodbye from Rich. And I was like, okay, cool. At that point, I decided that's what you were going to say in my head. So genuinely, at that point, I was thinking about what chocolate I have downstairs.
All right, we'll try it again. So it's goodbye from me, ADR Wargaming. Goodbye. It's goodbye from Mr. The Josh the War Hipster. Say goodbye, Josh.
Farewell.
It's goodbye from Jamie the Sanguinary Punk. Say goodbye, Jamie.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from Mr. Grotkin. There we are. And enjoy your hobby and, yeah, happy hobbying. Bye-bye.